I'm gonna check with you first. Sorry. Okay, let's do that again.
She got a little panicky.
Call to order the joint hearing. Oh, do you need to gavel too?
I need to do mine too. So you said.
Okay, so we'll call the. Well, we're calling to order a joint hearing, but why don't you gavel in as well? Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. I'm opening the House Energy Environment, House Interim Committee on Energy Environment for September 29th, 2015.
And we are the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. And we have a lengthy agenda today involving one item. You all know what it is. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, we have some housekeeping slash adoption of interim committee rules to take care of. So I guess we'll go first, and then you'll go, and then we're ready to go. So, yeah. So motion.
You want to go first?
Yeah.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2015.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 9th or 29th, 2015. Is there any discussion? These are committee members. These are, I've been told that these are the fairly standard boilerplate interim committee rules. And are there any changes from last interim?
Senator, no. It's my understanding that they're the same as last.
Okay. So is there any discussion among Senate members of the committee about adoption of the rules? Okay. Are there any objections to adoption of the rules as presented? Okay. Seeing no objections, the motion carries. Madam Co-Chair.
Chair Baker-Peterson, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2015.
Rep. Reardon moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2015. Is there any discussion from House members? Seeing none, is there any objection? They are on OLIS if anyone's interested in looking at them.
This is like a change.
Hearing no objection, the motion passes.
Okay, we are going to be having an informational hearing on the Federal Clean Power Plan. There are a lot of stakeholders affected by this, and we have prepared panels. Because this is we're going to do the best that we can to stick to the schedule, because we have 3 hours allotted, and we are short of the 3 hours by 7 minutes now. So. And I know that, and I presume that there'll be a lot of questions. So the first panel is going to be the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Energy, and the Public Utility Commission. They will be allotted an hour and a half. We'll probably have a lot of back and forth. And there'll be a number of questions, I imagine, by legislators on this panel. After that, we'll have 45 minutes for panel number two. That will be Climate Solutions, Citizens Utility Board, and the Global Warming Commission. And then after that, we'll have a 45-minute panel that will consist of Portland General Electric, Pacific Corp, Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, and EWEB. So those are the three panels. The first panel will have substantially more time because they're going to be presenting us with just like the basics about what the Clean Power Plan 111D rules do. So without any further elaboration, if the first panel could come forth, that would be great. That would be DEQ, Department of Energy, and PUC. I understand that you guys have a prepared presentation, and I don't know if it will go sequentially through your departments or you'll all be doing it together. I would suggest that members of the committee ask questions as they go, if it solidifies your understanding, but presenters feel free to say, we'll get to that in a few slides or by the end of the presentation. And with that, I think we're ready to rock and roll.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Edwards and Chair Baker-Peterson, members of the House Committee and Senate Committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm joined here today by Colin McConaughey, who's also with the Department of Environmental Quality, Andy Ginsberg with the Department of Energy, and Jason Eisendorf, who is with the Public Utility Commission. You've asked us here today to discuss EPA's Clean Power Plan, which is a recently adopted federal rule that limits CO2, carbon dioxide, emissions from existing natural gas and coal power plants. In cooperation with the governor's office, our agencies have been and will continue to work with the stakeholders in Oregon to identify the best approach to implement this rule in this state. What I think you'll hear from us today, and also from the stakeholders as well, is that there are many issues that must be weighed and considered as we develop a clean power plan, both in terms of the environmental outcome and in terms of the cost impact to Oregon utility customers. At this moment, the agencies are still evaluating the final rule, and we are working to appreciate the many policy issues and considerations that are involved. For those reasons, today's presentation is really only an initial assessment of the EPA rule. With time, our understanding of what approach to the Clean Power Plan best serves Oregon will grow as we do further analysis and continue our outreach with the stakeholders. So, we should probably get the slide up first, I guess. So, before we dive into the presentation, I do want to provide a quick overview of the Clean Power Plan rule and the discussion of the main elements. The Clean Power Plan is a new regulation published last month by EPA under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. The Clean Power Plan limits the emission of CO2, carbon dioxide pollution, from existing natural and coal gas and coal powered plants. By 2030, EPA expects this rule will reduce CO2 pollution from the power sectors by 32% compared with 2005 levels. EPA expects that this reduction in CO2 pollution will also reduce power plant emissions of other pollutants such as sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides that cause human health concerns, including asthma and heart attacks. It's important to know that EPA's Clean Power Plan is really focused on existing coal and gas-powered plants. And so it is primarily concerned with companies and utilities that own or otherwise rely upon power from these facilities. Here in Oregon, most of our consumer-owned utilities do not rely much on these sources, instead getting most of their power from our region's hydroelectric system. However, our state's two largest utilities, PGE and PacifiCorp, do own coal and gas power plants, and a significant portion of their power is generated from these fossil fuels. Additionally, Oregon has several gas power plants owned by independent companies that sell power output from these facilities into the larger regional market. So although much of Oregon is largely free from fossil-generated power, we still have significant connection to these resources, both from coal and gas generation within our border and from power imported from out of state. There's another important point I would like to make about EPA's Clean Power Plan, and that is that the rule allows the states to develop plans of their own for reducing CO2 emissions. Unlike many federal regulations that come down with fixed requirements, EPA has given states broad flexibility to determine what mechanisms are best suited for each state to ensure that coal and gas power plants collectively reduce CO2 emissions to the levels set by EPA. So before I hand it over to the real experts to talk about the final rule, I wanted to share a few initial observations about this final rule. First, the EPA Clean Power Plan rule has changed significantly from the draft rule that was proposed last year. And we won't cover each of the changes in great detail, but and we will certainly talk about some differences, but I did want to point out that the final rule addresses many of the concerns that Oregon agencies raised last year. First, EPA has corrected critical issues that were in the proposed rule, such as language that would have discouraged further energy efficiency investments in Oregon. EPA has also made changes in how they've set each state's emission goals, so they are not penalizing states like Oregon that have significant hydropower or other forms of renewable generation. EPA has also acknowledged that states will likely need more time to work with stakeholders and with neighboring states to consider the options for achieving EPA's emission requirements. EPA is now offering to extend the planning period out through 2018, and they've pushed out the start of compliance by 2 years so that it begins in 2022. EPA's changes to the final rule appear to provide Oregon with more viable compliance options and to more easily allow our utilities and power plant operators to trade with their counterparts in other states. These changes and the extra time from EPA are especially important if we want to assure our state plan can connect with other states to open up more cost-effective options for our utilities and power plant operators. Our initial assessment makes clear that our connection to other Western states through PGE and PacifiCorp means that what these other states do to comply with their own obligations under the Clean Power Plan will influence Oregon. This means that we may want to use the extra time EPA has provided to coordinate our plan with other states in the region. We are still very early in our assessment of the rule and our understanding of the larger regional and national landscape. Colin, Andy, and Jason will elaborate on these initial observations. Well, we expect to update you in the coming months as our understanding of the rule and the analysis of compliance options continues to grow. With that, I'll hand it over to Colin to begin explaining the Clean Power Plan rule and our options for developing an Oregon implementation plan.
Thank you, Palmer. For the record, my name is Colin McConaughey with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'll start out here with the outline of the remainder of our presentation this afternoon. I'm going to start over the next couple of slides just to provide a little background and context for the Clean Power Plan, and then really get right to the heart of the rule from EPA's standpoint at any rate, which is the emission target that they have developed for their rule. And then I'll cover some at a high level some of the main choices and compliance options that we as states have as we develop our plan to implement the Clean Power Plan here in Oregon. Then I'll hand it over to Andy and to Jason to explain some of the key considerations that we've identified at this early point in our assessment of the rule. And then I'll wrap up with some next steps that we envision over the coming months. Real briefly, this slide just notes a few of the key milestones that led us to where we are today in this process. Arguably, the path toward developing the Clean Power Plan began several years ago, but formally or legally, as I understand it, the process for developing the Clean Power Plan began back in September of 2013 when EPA proposed a carbon dioxide emission standard for new power plants. They proposed that under Section 111B of the Clean Air Act. And the way the Clean Air Act works is that, in this case, that triggered a requirement for EPA to then develop a rule to regulate CO2 emissions from existing power plants under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. And they did that in June of 2014 when they proposed a carbon dioxide regulation for existing power plants. That is what they called the Clean Power Plan. And that is the rule that we've that our agency is sitting here today have been working on with our stakeholders over the past year and a half to evaluate and understand and work with EPA to improve upon. And then what brought us here today was the issuance of the final Clean Power Plan from EPA. They issued that on August 3rd of this year, along with the final CO2 standard for new power plants. Real briefly, here are a few of the upcoming milestones that EPA has prescribed in the final Clean Power Plan. The first of which is a year from now, when EPA says that states will need to submit either a final state implementation plan or a progress report to EPA explaining how we have progressed in developing our state plan, our stakeholder outreach, and a request for an extension, at which point EPA says that they will grant states a two-year extension, meaning that we have actually until September of 2018 to finalize and submit our plan to EPA. And then the next milestone that EPA has identified comes in January of 2022, and that is when compliance will begin. That's when states will the emission reductions that EPA has requires of states will need to begin occurring. The way that the EPA has set their standard, it starts taking effect, as I say, in 2022, but the emission standard gets gradually more stringent until 2030, when the overall emission reductions that EPA requires in the rule take effect in January of 2030. Okay, just a little bit more context before I get into what EPA has finalized in their rule. And this is just setting the roles here. Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, as you know, is the part of the Clean Air Act that EPA is using for authority to issue the Clean Power Plan. And Section 111D works a little bit differently than a lot of regulations that come out of the Clean Air Act. In this case, it defines a real prominent role for states. And the two roles that I've listed here, the first is EPA's role, and that starts out directing EPA to develop an emission target that is composed of all the adequately demonstrated measures to reduce the pollutant in question from the facilities that they're targeting. So in this case, what that means is that EPA's role at the outset of this process is to develop an emission target composed of all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce CO2 emissions from existing coal and natural gas power plants. Once they've done that, they apply that emission target to each state to provide states with our own emission reduction goals. And I'll explain what those goals are here in the next few slides. But then once states have the goals, which is where we find ourselves today, now that we have the final plan, once states have these emission targets from EPA, it's then up to us to develop a plan to implement those emission goals. And those plans are composed of the mechanisms that we as states identify as our preferred mechanism for achieving those reductions. So long as we have one of the key factors here is that the state needs to have the authority to enforce whatever those mechanisms are that we identify as our preferred approach for achieving the reductions. So that's the context here for the rule. And now I'll get into what EPA has actually issued in their final rule. The heart of the Clean Power Plan is really the emission goals, as I've said, and the way EPA develops those goals, as I just mentioned, is to identify all the adequately demonstrated measures for reducing CO2 from coal and natural gas power plants. And the way they did that is they lumped these measures into three building blocks, as they refer to them. And the first building block that they list, or that they identify, is to make operational or physical improvements to the coal power plants to make them operate a little bit more efficiently. And what EPA found is that looking at nationally at the fleet of coal power plants across the country, there's relatively modest emission reductions that can be achieved by operating them more efficiently. There's about 2% improvement that can be made on average. But that is nonetheless the first building block, and it comprises a relatively small portion of the emission reductions that EPA is achieving with this rule. The next building block is where EPA begins to get more significant emission reductions. And here they look at the emission reductions that can be achieved by shifting generation away from coal power plants and onto existing natural gas power plants. Natural gas emits at about half the rate of coal, meaning that to generate a given amount of electricity, natural gas emits about half as much CO2 as coal. So by shifting generation away from coal and onto natural gas, EPA was able to find a fairly significant amount of emission reductions available across the country. And finally, the third building block that EPA uses in their emission target is to assess the amount of emission reductions that can be achieved by shifting generation away from both coal and gas onto non-emitting or renewable forms of energy generation. And once again, EPA found fairly significant emission reductions are achievable by doing this shift from coal and gas onto renewable energy. Should mention that there was a fourth building block for those of you that were familiar with the proposal that EPA issued a little more than a year ago. EPA had included originally in their proposal a fourth building block that was the emission reductions that can be achieved through energy efficiency by lowering our overall demand for energy. That they took that out of the emission guideline or the emission target that they've set here in the final rule, but they've been very clear that states can absolutely still use energy efficiency in our plans as a mechanism for achieving the reductions. Okay, so now that we understand a little bit about how EPA developed their emission target, what they assessed in that emission.
Representative Holvey.
I got to take a step back just to make sure I'm understanding this, if you don't mind, before you move on. So the proposed emission reduction targets from the EPA, looking at is the 111D portion of the proposal. So how do we and that's the existing power plants. Mm-hmm. So how does the emission reduction goals, how are they met with the addition of new power plants? Are they included in that reduction target?
Chair Edwards, Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Holvey, new coal and gas power plants are not, if that's what you're referring to, are not included in this rule, although EPA does give states the options to include them in our plans. If you're referring to the new generation that I mentioned about renewable energy and that shift away from coal and natural gas, that is included in what I'm about to explain here in these emission rate in these emission targets that the EPA has set for states. 11B. Okay. So yes, so the CO2 standard that EPA has set for new power plants under the 111B rule is separate from what we're talking about today in the Clean Power Plan. We'll mention a little bit about how EPA does give us the option as a state to bring those new sources under our Clean Power Plan.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to transition now to explaining a couple options that EPA gives states right at the outset to decide it when we're figuring out how we want to develop our implementation plan. EPA gives states two different types of emission targets, we need to pick one of these emission targets. The first is an emission rate, and as an emission rate, it is expressed as pounds of CO2 per unit of generation, or megawatt hour, and that's abbreviated capital M, capital W, little h. You'll see that abbreviation throughout the rest of this slide. So pounds of CO2 emissions per megawatt hour. That's the first way that EPA expresses the emission target. Alternatively, EPA gives states a second option to convert that emission rate target into a mass cap. And this is essentially like a ceiling on the overall amount of emissions, amount of CO2 that EPA would allow to be emitted collectively from the existing coal and natural gas power plants in the state. And these mass caps are expressed in tons of CO2. And this will make a little more sense, I hope, here in the next slide. So under this emission rate, this first option that EPA gives to states, there's actually two variations on it. And again, if a state needs to pick one of these. If we choose to pursue an emission rate target, we then need to select from one of these two options. The first is a pair of nationally uniform emission rates for coal and gas facilities. By using those three building blocks that I mentioned in the previous slide, EPA has determined that the emission rates that can be achieved on average nationwide by coal power plants is 1,305 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour of generation, and then for gas, 771 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour of generation. So those are nationally uniform rates. I say that because every state has the option to choose those emission rates and apply them to the coal and gas power plants in the state. Alternatively, a state can select its state specific emission rate, and this is unique to each state, and it is based on the weighted average of the coal and the gas generation in the state in the baseline year that EPA developed the rule, which was 2012. So for Oregon, our state-specific emission rate is 871 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. That's somewhere in between those two rates, but obviously a lot closer to the natural gas rate. And the reason for that is that we have a lot more natural gas in Oregon than we do coal. We have seven natural gas power plants in Oregon and one coal coal power facility here in Oregon. So for a state like Idaho that has all natural gas, its state-specific emission rate is the same as that natural gas rate, 771 pounds per megawatt hour. For a state like Montana that has coal power plants but no natural gas power plants within its borders, for Montana, its state-specific rate is the same as that coal rate, the 1,305 pounds per megawatt hour. So again, two different types of emission rate targets. If we take those nationally uniform emission rates, we need to apply those to the coal and gas rates, the coal and gas facilities, respectively. If we choose the state-specific rate, we choose that 871 pounds per megawatt hour. We apply that uniformly to all of the power plants in our state.
Yeah, that triggers a bunch of questions. So, Senator Whitsitt, and then Representative Verdon.
Thank you, Mr. McConaughey. I think it's my understanding there's a number of states who've chosen the third and parallel option, and that would be to challenge the legality of the EPA's 11D rule. I wonder, is Oregon joining them in that challenge in any way, or just moving forward with implementing the rule?
Chair Edwards and Senator Whitsitt, I don't believe that the state of Oregon has joined that lawsuit, or any of the lawsuits that I'm aware of on this rule.
Thank you.
These are just for power generated in our state, correct? Not power imported into the state.
Representative Reardon, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
And to clarify, 871, that is our current average, or that is our goal?
Senator Edwards, that is our goal in 2030. All of these goals are actually a little higher, a little less stringent at the outset in 2022 and ramp down to these numbers here.
Okay. Other questions? While we're paused for a moment. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So moving on to explain that the second type of emission target that states can select, again, that's the mass cap. So this is not an emission rate, but just an overall total tonnage of CO2 emissions that would be allowed within the state from the existing coal and natural gas power plants. For what EPA has done here is given states a state-specific mass cap based on the state-specific emission rate. So in our case, that's the 871 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. Taken that rate and applied it by the generation in the baseline year. In Oregon, that was the coal and gas generation in 2012. And then added in some additional generation that they've assumed could be constructed for renewable energy. So in our case, what that amounts to is 8.1 million tons of CO2. Again, that's out in 2030. So that would be the total amount of CO2 that could be emitted by the existing coal and gas power plants in Oregon. And we'll keep explaining what these targets mean as I go along here and explain some of these options, because the emission rate and the mass cap option are pretty fundamental to and then inform future choices that I'll get to here in the next few slides. So this slide here shows essentially an abbreviated decision tree. This at a high level, these are some of the key choices and the types of plans that states have to select from. And the first question I've listed there on the left-hand side is which type of emission goal does the state want to pursue? An emission rate, as I just described, or a mass cap. And I'll focus here on the top branch of this decision tree first, which is if we were to select an emission rate target, then our next choice is essentially whether we want to design a state plan that works for the most part strictly here in Oregon, or whether we want to choose a plan that will allow some form of interaction with other states. And I'll explain a little bit more of that, as will Andy and Jason here in a few moments, about how we can connect our plan with other states and allow trading of compliance instruments. But
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
While you're doing the presentation, you give us your pluses and minuses on those different things instead of just telling us what we can do, since y'all are the certified smart, so we kind of know what might be routes for us to be considering, pluses and minuses.
So, Senator Przanski, I think what we are aiming to do today is maybe not so much in the sense of pluses and minuses, but try to highlight for you and the other members what the issues are, the policy issues that go along with these different choices. I'm only interpreting the question, and if I'm interpreting it the wrong way, please tell me. In terms of pluses and minuses, that might have us giving a statement of what we think is best, and I don't know that we're able to do that today. So I think we're trying to be very careful to just illuminate what the issues are, what the various considerations that need to be discussed and analyzed before we can sort of move to the next step of what's the best path forward. If you certainly have questions about a particular point in the presentation, stop us and let us try to answer your question. But I guess I'm just trying to be very careful about suggesting that we know what's best today, because I don't think we do.
Yeah, which I think is a fair characterization. My conversations with folks in the administration haven't necessarily taken a position on what, like, we should do this, but this is step one and kind of, uncovering everything and the things that the administration needs to consider and that we need to consider. So, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for all this work. I'm interested in the we part of this discussion, and that is, who is it that the federal government looks to in this delegation of responsibility? I'm not even sure it's a delegation. That's what I'm really asking. I was just looking here at how the federal government, when it suggests these standards, then, quote, delegates to the states the authority of meeting those standards. So a state, I'm really trying to ask, what is it that this legislature can do other than sit and watch as departments do their best to struggle with these kinds of issues? What part should this legislative group play in this activity? Are we consigned to sit here and watch? Or if we're unhappy with what you come up with, what do we do about it?
So, Chair Edwards, Chair Vega Peters, and Representative Bentz, I think that's probably the $64,000 question. And it's a real question. I don't think we have a position or even able to kind of give you an answer to that today. Again, like I told Senator Przanski, I think we want to lay out the issues. And in laying out those issues, I think that begins the conversation, both with this body as well as the executive branch, about what issues are the type that are perhaps more legislative appropriate as opposed to those that are more maybe within the realm of the executive agencies to try to make decisions on. I don't think today we can totally point to an answer to that question. I think we're starting a conversation with you, the other members, and the stakeholders about how best to move forward. So I just want to, I'm not at all trying to be evasive. I just think we're early in this process.
Thank you. And I was just looking at this language. It says, in this general discussion about delegation, in order for a delegation to occur, the state legislature must have passed authorizing legislation that is at least as stringent as the federal standard, while demonstrating the state has adequate resources to run the program. But I'm not sure that's what's going on here. Is this different than that? Do we have to pass something in order for you to move forward?
Yeah. Representative Bentz, not to be evasive or to feel like to drum the same drumbeat here, but I don't know that we know the answer to that either. I think I understand the EPA final rule, and Colin or any of these gentlemen can jump in, is we certainly have to have an enforceable plan. Meaning that it's got to be enforceable based on the basis of statutory authority, such that the agencies in the state of Oregon can implement it. As we develop a plan, as we look to what that might be, I think those questions will be raised about whether we have adequate statutory authority to implement the plan we want to implement. But I don't know that we know the answer to that yet.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Since this plan obviously transitions us from coal into natural gas, does this plan include a contingency in case we have a problem with securing natural gas so that we're not left with no base load?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, yes, as I understand it, there is a provision in the rule that EPA included added for the final rule about the reliability of the at the state, regional, and national level for our electricity system. That in the event that there are serious concerns raised by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, or I believe others, this rule can be reevaluated or paused. It's a part of the rule that I honestly have not paid a lot of attention to. It is something I think that happens, I believe, at the federal level. But EPA makes clear that they don't intend this rule to impact the reliability of the electricity sector in any way.
Follow up. If we dismantle our coal generating systems and we switch over exclusively to natural gas, what happens if we have that catastrophic problem where we can't get natural gas? What do we do? What are we left with? Renewables? And how do our major suppliers, PGE and PacifiCorp, how do they supply us since they're not connected into the hydro system?
Senator Olson, I actually don't believe that EPA sees this rule as getting rid of coal entirely. I think it does envision a transition to greater reliance, as you say, on natural gas and on renewables. But at least the stringency of the rule that we have today does not appear to remove all of that baseload coal.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Continue.
Okay, I believe I was stating that really if we choose an emission rate target, one of our next questions that we need to ask ourselves is whether we want to design a plan that can connect with other states or whether we want the plan to be concerned only with the power plants that operate here in Oregon. This is important because if we choose that state-specific rate at 871 pounds that I mentioned in the previous slide, that Oregon-specific emission rate target, in that case, EPA says there's very little way for our utilities and power plant operators to interact with their counterparts in other states. And again, I'll explain, and Jason and Andy will as well, a little bit more about what we mean about these regional considerations, these multi-state considerations. But suffice it to say at this point, I think that if we want to design an emission rate plan that can connect easily and simply with other states, then EPA is pretty clear that we need to adopt those nationally uniform coal and gas rates that every state can select from, in which case, at that point, our plan can interact fairly simply with any other state plan that selects national coal and gas emission rates.
Mr. Jones? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. McConaughey. If the state of Oregon were to join with other states in creating a plan, given the relatively small population of Oregon compared to, say, Washington and California, could you explain to us how Oregon would be bound to that plan and how Oregon would extricate it from that plan if it wasn't working for them? So, for instance, with the Pacific Coast Collaborative, if it was doing something like that.
Senator Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I actually think that the way EPA has designed the final rule is a little simpler than what we had in the proposal, whereby we are actually not signing a multi-state plan necessarily with other states. We're not signing onto a multi-state plan necessarily with California or Washington to allow our companies, our utility companies and power plant operators to work with their counterparts in those states. What EPA has said is we simply need to adopt a plan that has a similar structure to any other state that we'd like to interact with. And if we find that in the course of things that's not operating the way we had intended or is otherwise not as beneficial as we had hoped for Oregon, my understanding is that states have pretty broad flexibility to resubmit a plan to EPA to change things around. So in that event, perhaps we might want to submit a plan that makes it our plan or our state more autonomous and separated from those states. I think EPA envisions an opportunity for states to do that.
So are we talking about compatibility, not a compact?
Chair, yes, that's correct. That's a good way to characterize it. So.
I just would like to know that if we choose to work with another state, that our total reduction in carbon will be the maximum possible under, as though we had worked separately. Is there a way to ensure that we're making the greatest carbon reduction possible, regardless of how we configure our plan?
Representative Reardon, that's a good question, and one that I think we need to explore further in evaluating these options.
Sure. I wanted to get that question on the record, though.
Senator Brzozowski.
So, understanding that we could set these compacts or these groups of states, is there some type of guidance we have as to who we can actually pair up or partner with? And does that have to be an adjacent state? Does that have to be, I mean,
Senator Brzozowski, good question. And no, it does not. It really only needs to be another state that has adopted a plan of a similar structure. In the example I just mentioned, if Oregon were to adopt those national uniform coal and gas rates, theoretically anyway, EPA has said that our plan can link up then with any other state that has adopted those national coal and gas rates.
Got it.
Excellent. Yeah. So before I move on to
Representative Boone.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. Would it make sense to partner as a region with the states that belong to the Northwest Power Planning Council?
Representative Boone, that's certainly one option, and we have some pretty strong ties through the Northwest Power Planning Council and otherwise to other states in the Northwest. So, and those are states certainly that are absolutely on our radar that we're talking with, states like Washington, Idaho, and Montana. Okay, before I move to the other part of that decision tree that I was showing in the previous slide, I want to take a minute to explain something that's real important about if we were to adopt an emission rate target, what we would need to do, what EPA tells states, is that we will need to have what they call emission rate credits, or ERCs. And these take the form of a megawatt hour of generation with no emissions associated with it. And these are critical compliance instruments for coal and natural gas power plants, because they are the mechanism by which they are able to really effectively lower their emission rates down to the required emission rate targets. Those targets that I mentioned in a few slides ago, the national coal and gas rates, or the state-specific rates, those emission rates that EPA has set for states and for coal and gas power plants are not generally feasible to be achieved at the facilities themselves. So what they need to do, and EPA recognizes this, and then what they say, the mechanism for then achieving these emission rates is for these coal and gas power plants to acquire these emission rate credits, or ERCs, in sufficient number to essentially dilute their emission rates down to whatever is required of them. And here on this next slide, to better explain that, we have an example here, just a very basic hypothetical example with some round numbers to make the math easy to illustrate the point here. In this example, we have a natural gas power plant that's operating in a state that requires it to achieve an emission rate of 1,000 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour of generation. And this natural gas plant happens to actually emit 50% higher than that, at 1,500 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour of generation. So the mechanism, the way that it is able to comply is to acquire 5 of these emission rate credits, or ERCs. And you'll see the math there in the table illustrating that by adding those 5 ERCs, that dilutes the emission rate of that facility down to the required 1,000 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. I should explain that these emission rate credits, go to the next slide, there's some important requirements or stipulations that EPA prescribes for these emission rate credits. These emission rate credits are generated by renewable energy or energy efficiency. There's some other mechanisms to do so, but for the most part, these ERCs are generated by renewable energy and energy efficiency, but with some important restrictions. And the first one of those is that EPA says, for renewable energy or energy efficiency to produce an ERC, it has to have been built or installed after 2012. So what that means is that a wind turbine that was built in 2011 and that is still generating power in 2022 and beyond in the compliance period, that wind turbine cannot generate an ERC. Instead, it needs to have been built in 2013 or later. So what EPA is after here is for states to develop new renewable energy and install new energy efficiency. And furthermore, what EPA also requires states to develop pretty robust administrative systems to issue these ERCs, to track them, and to track the sale and trading of them and the ultimate retirement of these ERCs for compliance. And then also to employ third-party verifiers to ensure that these ERCs are only going to creditable forms of renewable energy and energy savings. So it's just an important point that, that states will need to have some pretty robust new administrative systems to adopt these this emission rate crediting scheme. And then the final bullet here on this slide, it's important to note that EPA has not by default allowed biomass generation to be credited, though EPA says that states can propose in our plans to credit certain forms of biomass feedstocks if we can make the case that they are the use of that biomass for energy is in fact carbon neutral.
On your statement on renewable built prior to 2012, we have a lot of wind farms out there. How many of those would fall into this category of being built after 2012?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, Jason just reminded me that PGE's Toucannon Farm wind farm was built later than 2012, although that is in Washington. It is operated and owned, by PGE. So I think there is a significant amount of renewable energy out there that, in Oregon that was built prior to 2013.
And for the record, I'm Andy Ginsberg with the Oregon Department of Energy. Just to add to that, indirectly, we still get credit for our existing renewable energy because it's the reason that our current emissions are where they are. And so, as you'll see in a slide that I'll show a little bit later on, we've already made significant progress towards meeting these goals, and we only have to get from there to our ultimate goals by using these new ERCs. So while you can't generate an ERC from older renewables, it still has helped us to reduce our emissions up till now.
Senator Whitson.
Comment first, obviously that eliminates hydro. But the question, what is the potential cost per each unit of ERC and the potential effect on the utility's ratepayer charges when those are implemented?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, that is very valuable. If I knew the answer to that question, it would be very, very valuable. I think that's something that we will be working hard to determine. It's a complicated question, depending not only on what we in Oregon do, but also on the larger regional market, what other states from which we import power. That Jason will explain more about this regional connection and consideration, but it really depends on the marketplace that crops up, what the basic supply and demand for these credits are, and that's something that we simply can't know yet.
Follow up. So the question is, no one there at the table has an estimate even?
No.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. So this really reminds me of, 2007, when the RPS was being developed. And the year was chosen, and nobody has ever really told me how they chose that year, 1994 or whatever. And now this is 2012. I mean, who chose the year, and why was it 2012 and not 2010 or 11? And then I know this is like a multiple question. Has somebody got a list of what the projects are, the renewable projects are, and the year they were built, and how much they are producing?
And before you answer, we are not yet halfway through this first slide deck. We still have two more presenters. We're two-thirds of the way through the meeting that you guys have allotted, so keep it brief, if you could, please. And then I'm going to respectfully ask the committee members to focus on decision points for us in your questions so that we can get through these guys and then two more panels by five. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Representative Boone, 2012 was the baseline, was the year that EPA used to develop most of this rule. It was happened to be the year for which there was the most complete national level data on generation and emissions across the country when they began developing this rule. That's essentially the line in the sand that they drew and said, okay, things prior to this were existing conditions as we've evaluated them for this rule. Things later than that are essentially new through the looked at through the lens of this rule. And as far as a list of projects in their year, that is absolutely something that that we can get to you. I don't have that with me.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on. Now, that second branch here in the decision tree, this is if we were to select that mass cap emission target. We have a similar question in front of us then as to whether we want to design this plan to really work just for Oregon or whether we want our plan to connect with other states. If we decide that we want to design a plan that will work just for the state of Oregon, EPA gives states an option that they call a state measures approach. And what that entails is essentially a state submits a plan that shows to EPA that we have in place existing enforceable policies that will ensure that the emissions from our coal and gas power plants collectively do not exceed the mass cap. That would entail showing them some data and analysis to suggest that the policies in place will ensure those emissions stay below the cap. And then EPA would require that the state have what they call a backstop plan, a plan that that would be ready and waiting to be triggered in the event that the state is not able to keep the emissions beneath the mass cap. And that backstop plan would need to include enforceable measures placed directly on the power plants themselves. However, if we want to pursue this mass cap system and also be able to interact with other states, then what EPA directs to the states that we need to is that we have essentially a pool of what they call emission allowances, and that they need to figure out how to allocate these emission allowances. And I'll explain what I mean by that here on the next slide. An emission allowance is essentially a permit to emit one ton of CO2. You may recall that I mentioned in a previous slide that EPA set the 2030 mass cap for Oregon at 8.1 million tons. That means that the state has 8.1 million emission allowances that we would need to allocate or somehow use. And I'll explain the options for that here in the next slide. But essentially, these are permissions to emit one ton of CO2. And coal and gas power plants that are subject to this rule would need to hold a sufficient number of emission allowances at the end of each compliance period to cover their total emissions. Let's go to the next slide here, and I'll explain one of the big considerations for a state that pursues this type of approach in its plan is how to allocate these emissions. And we're very, very early on in our assessment of this. We have really only at this point worked out some of the main options in front of us for how to allocate these allowances. I've listed some of the main ones here on this slide. The direct allocation option entails the state directly handing over these allowances to different entities. It's easy to imagine that entities that state might allocate these emission allowances to would be the power plant operators themselves, the companies that have a compliance obligation under this regulation. EPA contemplates states allocating these emission allowances to other entities like renewable energy providers or energy efficiency acquisition companies that don't have a compliance obligation under this rule. And in this case, state would be allocating emission allowances to these companies essentially as a financial incentive because that renewable energy generator or energy efficiency acquirer could then sell that emission allowance to a power plant operator who needed it to cover their emissions. Another option for allocating allowances would be to auction them. I think that's a pretty straightforward concept at the very highest level. There's a lot of nuances there that we need to explore if that was something that the state wanted to pursue. That we could also simply retire some of these allowances, meaning that they would not be used to cover emissions. And that's been proposed as a mechanism for states to increase the stringency of the rule by retiring some allowances, not allowing them to cover emissions. That can increase the amount of emission reductions that the rule might be able to achieve. And finally, the other option listed up there is for the state to bank the allowances, meaning that the state would not allocate them initially, but hold on to them and potentially reserve the right to allocate those emission allowances at a later date. There's a lot of other considerations. As I say, we're very early on in our assessment of this. Just to throw out one of them to illustrate another nuance here is that there's a timing or a phasing component to this, whereby the state could choose a certain allocation regime at the outset, say in 2022 when compliance begins, and gradually transition to a different allocation regime. So, for example, directly allocating all of the allowances at the outset of the compliance period and gradually transitioning perhaps to an auction or to retiring or banking those allowances. But a lot more to come on this. This is an area that warrants a lot more exploration. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Andy Ginsberg.
Okay. Chair Edwards, Chair Vega-Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm with the Oregon Department of Energy. So now that Colin's provided an overview of the Clean Power Plan, Jason and I will highlight a few considerations that we've identified from our initial assessment of the final rule, as well as our discussions with stakeholders. First, I'll talk a little bit about where we are relative to the target, where Oregon's emissions are relative to the target. And then I'll talk about a concept that EPA calls leakage and what our options are for addressing it in our compliance plan. And after that, I'll describe the Clean Energy Incentive Program, which is essentially a EPA included to encourage states to continue pursuing renewable energy and energy efficiency prior to the date that the plan requires us to meet the specific targets. And then last, Jason will discuss some of the important considerations about whether to develop a plan that focuses mainly on Oregon's compliance or compliance at fossil power plants within Oregon, or as Colin said, whether we want to design our plan so that it can easily hook up with other states so that we would potentially address the emissions from fossil plants in Oregon and other states that serve our load. So turning first to where we stand in Oregon, this chart shows the targets for Oregon, and I'm using the mass-based approach here just for illustration purposes. Again, we haven't made any kind of a decision about whether it's more beneficial for Oregon to take the rate-based emission rate-based approach or the mass cap approach, but it is easier to illustrate the numbers using the mass cap approach, so that's why I'm using it. The upper line on this chart is the interim target that applies in 2022, and then the lower line is our final target, as Colin said, 8.1 million tons of carbon dioxide that would apply in the year 2030 and beyond. And then in between these two lines, but not shown, there are two additional targets that go into effect in 2025 and 2028. So it's a gradual step down every couple of years. So if Oregon were to select the mass cap approach, our emissions would have to be below these lines in the years that they apply. So this now shows our current emissions in Oregon from all of the natural gas and coal power plants that would be subject to the Clean Power Plan for the years 2010 through 2014. And so it's important to remember that the targets do not apply until 2022. So this is just for illustrative purposes to show where we are. But you can immediately see from looking at this chart that if those targets were in effect today, we'd all already be pretty close to meeting them. And I think this gets at one of the questions you asked earlier. It really reflects already the tremendous work that Oregon has done in reducing our emissions by pursuing energy efficiency and renewable energy in our state. But looking ahead to 2022, there are a number of factors that will determine whether or not our emissions stay below that line or go up or go down. Probably the biggest one is that in 2020, the use of coal at the Boardman power plant will cease. And that plant emits over 3.5 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. So this, added with our ongoing energy efficiency and renewable energy work that will happen between now and 2022, will bring our emissions down well below this cap. On the other hand, there are other factors that could cause our emissions to go up. And some of the questions we have are, to what extent will the Boardman's emissions be made up from increased generation at natural gas plants that are subject to the cap? And how much of Oregon's load growth will be met by natural gas plants that are subject to the cap? And will those plants increase generation to meet increased demand from California or other states, either caused by this plan or by other factors? Another really important question is whether EPA will consider PGE's Cardi generating station to be an existing plant that's subject to this rule or a new plant that's subject to the new plant standards. And that's an issue that I'm sure that you'll hear more about from PGE on a subsequent panel, so I won't go into it now. And finally, will Oregon decide to include new power plants under our cap as a way to address leakage, which is the topic I'm going to talk about in just a minute. So all this is very uncertain, and we need to do a lot more analysis before we know how we'll fare under the final rule when it goes into effect in 2022. But for now, we have a couple of takeaways, and one is that we appear to be in a much better situation than we were under the proposed rule. As Colin said, EPA was pretty responsive to the issues that we raised in the proposed rule. But we can't assume that we won't have any challenges in complying. And we also need to consider the situation in neighboring states from which we import power, and that's an issue that Jason will talk about in a minute.
Representative Boone.
Yes.
Can you tell us, thank you, why 2011 was such a dip down?
Well, the year-to-year emissions vary for a number of reasons. The hydro year is a big factor. Colin, do you have more information about the specific shape of the line?
Representative Boone, no, I don't in that particular year. My understanding is that that was a very high water year. So as Andy mentioned, a good hydro year means less reliance on our coal and gas facilities.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone, that's another important consideration when we design our plan. We have to recognize that we will have variation, and we can't design a plan that will meet the targets only in a high water year. We have to be able to meet it in a low water year as well. So moving on, now I'm going to turn to this issue of leakage, and this gets back to an issue that we talked about a little while ago when we talked about how our plan links up with plans in other states and the question of compatibility. If our plans are not compatible, then there can be this this situation that EPA calls leakage. And basically, leakage is a term that's used to describe how some of the expected carbon dioxide reductions from the Clean Power Plan might be lost or leak away due to the interconnected nature of the grid, and then differences between the way state plans are designed or the way state targets are set, or whether new plants are included or not included under the cap. And some observers have estimated that leakage could reduce the overall effectiveness of the Clean Power Plan by as much as 30%. So it's not an insignificant issue, and it's an issue the EPA spends quite a few pages in the preamble discussing, and they include a number of requirements for states to meet in our compliance plans to make sure that we're addressing leakage adequately. The final rule mentions several different types of leakage, but the one that EPA is most concerned about is leakage under states that select the mass cap compliance approach. And the leakage they're most concerned about in that case would be from existing plants to new plants. So getting to the question that Representative Holby was asking. So EPA has, because of this, EPA requires states to address leakage if they select the mass cap approach, and we have to include some way of addressing leakage in our compliance plan. And they've given basically two options for states to address leakage. One is to include new plants under the cap. And in that case, if we did that, EPA would raise that cap from 8.1 million tons to a higher level to accommodate the growth that would be expected to be taken up by the new plants. Another option EPA provided is for states to just include the existing plants, but use our allocation method in a way that reduces the incentive for leakage to occur. And it's very complex, but it's EPA has provided a couple of sub-options where we can allocate allowances to existing coal plant or existing natural gas plants in a way that would encourage utilities to operate them rather than shift generation to new natural gas plants, or to allocate allowances to renewable energy and energy efficiency in a way that reduces the incentive for new the generation to shift to new plants. So that's an issue that we'll have to address if we select the mass cap compliance approach. And EPA has said that they're going to continue to evaluate this after states submit their plans, and they may add additional requirements in the future.
Senator Olson.
I'd like a clarification. What EPA is saying is they don't want us to build newer, more efficient plants. They want us to run the older ones so that we don't have leakage.
Senator Olson, not exactly. EPA is assuming that new plants will be built, but what they're trying to avoid is a situation where a new plant is built, say, to address new load. And then after it's built, a company would reduce generation at an existing plant and increase generation at that new plant, so that really emissions aren't reduced at all. They're just shifted from existing to new plants. So the idea is that if we have a compliance plan that only addresses the existing plants under a cap, it would just be kind of a hole in the cap if you could move emissions over to the new plants. But certainly the new plants would be more efficient. Okay, moving on, the last issue that I'm going to discuss is the Clean Energy Incentive Program. And this is basically a program that EPA included in the final rule to create an incentive for states to continue pursuing renewable energy and energy efficiency in the years before the plan goes into effect in 2022. And specifically, it's focused on wind and solar energy, as well as demand-side energy efficiency in low-income communities. So EPA is still taking comments on aspects of the Clean Energy Incentive Program, although they did include the program in the final rule. And basically, they are setting aside some additional allowances or emission reduction credits that will be available to states that participate in the program. And then states would have access to these allowances or credits, and they can use them throughout the compliance period, sort of like a banked credit. There's a couple important timing requirements. Projects have to begin after the state submits our compliance plan, our final approvable compliance plan. And the measures have to still continue generating renewable energy or energy savings during the years 2020 and 2021. So those are the 2 years you can get early credit for. And then last, EPA says that they want to give priority for states to access the extra allowances that they've set aside, give priority to those states that have a more stringent or more challenging target. But that doesn't mean that Oregon won't have any access to the program. It just means that we have to think carefully about how to design our program and have discussions about EPA about the most effective way to include the early action in our program. So with that, I think I'm ready to turn it over to Jason.
Good afternoon. Before moving forward, Jason, Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My general question is, outside of the federal litigation, are there things that can derail the Clean Power Plan as it's implemented in Oregon? And I'm specifically interested in what you're just talking about here, and whether there's a disincentive somehow to bringing on renewable projects between now and when we get credit for them after 2020. And are there any other disincentives to bringing on renewable power projects that this Clean Power Plan might represent?
Representative Baker Peterson, Representative Helm, I don't think there are other disincentives. The idea is just that because you only get credit for the emission reductions that occur after 2022, or that's when the plan goes into effect, EPA was concerned that states might wait or hold back on projects that they might have otherwise, and utilities might hold back on projects they might have otherwise gone forward with and wait and do them when they can get credit for them. This at least partially eliminates that disincentive and encourages states to continue moving forward. So there's nothing in the requirement that would prevent Oregon from continuing with our existing programs.
Thank you. Jason.
Good afternoon, Chair Peggy Peterson, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Utility Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. I have five slides, and I'll try to run through them as swiftly as I can to open it up for additional questions. I'm going to discuss Oregon's compliance in the context of the Western states' compliance, how Oregon is connected to other states in the West. But before we get there, there's a threshold question of whether or not Oregon even wants to play with other states in the West. The EPA clearly, as Colin mentioned, anticipated that there are a couple of ways that Oregon can identify an implementation plan where Oregon is largely on its own. That is in the state measures approach and the state-specific rate approach. The state measures approach is sort of a little bit easier to describe. I think Colin already did it. It's really the state telling EPA, we're going to be okay, we're going to meet our mass-based cap through a mix of programs and policies that cover the electricity generating unit and other state policies such as renewable portfolio standard and energy efficiency programs. And EPA looks at that and says, yes, you are likely to comply. As Colin said, EPA would also require the state to have a backup plan in that case. But the consequence would be Oregon being able to comply without really having to do anything with any other state. We just sort of close off our borders, ignore everybody else, and we're sort of done. That has some attractiveness, I suppose, in terms of simplicity and self-control. What it doesn't do, and dealing with the second large bullet there, it doesn't allow Oregon to take advantage of some of the trading opportunities that we had been talking about earlier. So under an emission rate path, the trading instrument there is the emission rate credit, the ERC. Assuming some states go, other states go emission rate path also, there will be a market formed over trading what those ERCs are. What the value and the price of those are, we don't know yet because we don't know how many states are going to go in that direction or the available ERCs they may be able to generate. So it really is a matter of supply and demand there. Similarly, under a mass-based cap, if a number of states go in mass-based, there will be a trading in allowances. So that trading platform around allowances will emerge. So the bar graph I'm about to show you after this one is going to show you what we think our relative position compared to other Western states is likely to look like. And before we get there, sort of a reminder about the reason that we think that we're going to be in reasonably good shape. And that is because in Oregon we've had a couple of decades of pretty good clean energy policy centered around the energy efficiency programs, the renewable portfolio standard. At the commission, we still rely very heavily on integrated resource plans and the least cost, least risk approach. I think, as Andy said, with the closure of Boardman Coal Plant at the end of 2020, that is going to have a significant positive impact on our ability to comply. And that closure is itself a function of the least cost, least risk path through the Commission's IRP process. Okay, so next. Okay, so this slide has two very different and very important points on it. On the right side of the graph, you can see the bars that extend from zero and below. Basically, what this is looking at are states, including Oregon, California, and Washington, if you take our 2012 emission baseline and you subtract our known coal plant closures, in this case we're talking about Boardman, if you compare that that baseline minus coal emissions to the 2030, the end emission guideline, Oregon looks like it is in reasonably good shape to comply. The states on the left are states that are going to have more of a challenge in complying. Looking at their 2012 emissions and comparing that to the 2030 mass cap for each one of those states, they are going to have more emissions than their cap would allow, and so they're going to be in a position where they have to reduce emissions. So point number one is, all other things aside, and there are frankly a lot of other things having to do with leakage, whether we go mass-based or rate-based, and a variety of other toggles that may be out there. If you put them all aside for a minute, on its face, it looks like Oregon is in reasonably good shape for compliance. Point number two is on the left. If you notice that among those states are Montana, Wyoming, and Utah. Montana and Wyoming and Utah are hooked to PGE and PacifiCorp ratepayers. PGE and PacifiCorp ratepayers are nearly 70% of the load in the state. Both PGE has, I'll show you more specifically in a moment, ownership of coal plants in Montana. So as Montana attempts to comply with the 2030 goal, it is likely that Montana and potentially PGE are going to incur costs to get Montana to that compliance point. Those costs are going to be flowed through rates. Similarly, PacifiCorp has a significant amount of coal facilities in both Utah and Wyoming. As you can see from the bar graph, both of those states also are going to have challenge to comply. Costs of compliance are going to flow through rates into Oregon.
Okay. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? I was going to save this question to the end, but we're getting close to the end anyway. So I'm looking for a little bit more clarity about what the existing, as they've been promulgated, the Clean Power Plan rules allow, and then what decision point we may have as a state. So if we're talking about allowances, and if I understand correctly, they're not the state's allowances, they're the utilities. The utilities would have, well, entities within the state could generate allowances under different systems. And we will be, in the state of Oregon, will be well positioned for ultimate compliance, but a utility with a broad footprint, say PacifiCorp, because they have generation in other states that are going to have a difficult time complying, can they use credits from Oregon to comply there? And does that, I'm trying to follow the flow of the money, does the money get back to the sale of those credits, or the use of those credits, does that help the ratepayers that paid for them for years get the benefit of that, or do the current shareholders of PacifiCorp, for example, get that, or do the ratepayers in those states get the utility of those credits? I'm trying to understand what decisions we have to make, or agencies have to make, and that are a benefit to our ratepayers.
So, Chair Edwards, you sort of hit the big series of decision points. This is what a lot of those toggles are all going to be about, and it goes back to a slide that Colin showed about how does the state allocate its allowances. So I guess I would argue at this point that the allowances are the state's allowances. It's the state's determination about how to then allocate them. Depending upon the choices in allocation allowance, Those allowances could be sold to a utility in Wyoming to enable a utility in Wyoming to comply, whether it's Pacific Corp or even another utility. That could generate revenue for the state of Oregon to cycle back into the electricity sector. As you say, the headroom is essentially purchased by ratepayers investing in various resources that helped us get below the 2030 cap. Those allowances could be retired, as Colin said, and to try to achieve greater carbon reduction than the Clean Power Plan assumes. The allowances could be generated through renewable energy or energy efficiency providers to allow them to raise money to acquire more energy efficiency and more renewables that helps us keep that headroom. Or those allowances could be either given to or the proceeds given to a utility like Pacific Corp or PGE, whose rates may tend to go up based on what other states are going to do, and act as a form of rate hike insurance, I suppose. So there is a broad range of possibilities there. One important point is we're in better shape than some places. We're in better shape than some of our neighboring western states. As I said, none of us four here are going to promise anything, because how much headroom there is going to depend entirely on whether or not the mass-based approach covers existing only or existing and new, how we deal with leakage. So we're not in a position at this point to sort of tell you that we have headroom forever, or how much that might be or how long that might exist. But in terms of based on the bar graph, we start from a better place than most. And I think most of the rest of the discussion with stakeholders is going to be, how do you use those allowances to the best effect?
Thank you for the clarification. I think this is my fourth presentation on the rules, and I'm starting to get it. So
me too.
And every time I get, there's one light bulb goes off and go, okay, got it. So,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those same lines, so one, I think I heard that there's a mechanism by which we can use our credits to hold our own ratepayers harmless as Pacific Corp changes its energy mix, energy generation mix. But second, is there a mechanism by which, if we do surrender some of our credits to Montana and the states in Pacific Corp's jurisdiction, so to speak, can we earmark it and say, you can use this, these credits, but you can't use them just to buffer your coal business. You have to use them to move out of coal and into gas. Or is that what the Clean Power Plan will already require?
Chair Edwards, Representative Helm, first of all, let me just clarify. I don't know that we can necessarily hold all customers harmless, but we can. But as you said, one possibility is to address rate impacts. I just want to clarify. I don't want to make any promises here.
I wasn't trying to put words in your mouth, yeah. But that's what I want.
Okay. In terms of earmarking them, I think that is an issue that the agencies and the stakeholders are going to explore. Precisely how could and would those allowances be used, and to what effect?
Yes, sort of.
That's something coming.
Senator, what's it?
Thank you. This is kind of stepping ahead, but Mr. Eisendorf, you're really just a target of opportunity from the PUC. The Global Warming Commission talks about we're currently emitting about 61 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. They're saying that the carbon price signal that they hope to achieve, the goal is $60 per ton of carbon dioxide emission. That calculates to $3.66 billion a year, the B. And 30% of that comes from electric plants, so you're talking about $1.43 billion a year in carbon tax. So the question, there's a couple of questions. How does that philosophy jibe with the ERC that you're talking about? Secondly, when would the PUC be able to give us some indication of what that additional $1.43 billion in ratepayer cost, how that would compute in percentage increase and cents per kilowatt hour increase in, I mean, just, I'm struggling with the two different concepts.
And Chair Edwards, Senator Winston, if we go to the next slide, let me address your second question as directly as I can. And it may not surprise you to know or to hear that the answer in terms of rate impact is I don't know. And let me sort of run down the list of reasons why we don't know at this point. We don't know what approach Oregon is going to take yet. We don't know if Oregon's going to take an emission rate base or a mass base. We don't know how Oregon is going to allocate those allowances, if they're all to rate impacts or are they all to carbon emissions. We don't know if we went mass based, if we would cover existing only or existing and new, and how much headroom we would have in the latter in terms of allowances. We don't know what other states are going to do. We don't know the fungibility and the liquidity of certain markets, either ERCs or allowances. And then finally, we don't know as PacifiCorp, for example, goes out and attempts to make changes to its own resource stack to help Wyoming and Utah comply. Those are decisions that are going to have to come through the PUC, and the PUC is going to make a prudence determination on that and whether or not those costs get borne by the ratepayer. So there are somewhere between a half a dozen and a dozen sort of major toggle points that make it extremely difficult to determine at this point what a rate impact might look like.
Madam Co-Chair?
Thank you, Chair. So a couple questions. I think in all that list of things that we don't know yet, one of them is we don't really have any signals yet from other states as far as which direction that they're going at this point. Is that correct? Okay, and then follow up.
Yeah.
And then, so I guess what I would like to see is what are some of one of the decision points, you know, it's going to be mass versus rates, what we're going to do about leakage, and whether we should go solo or whether we're going to go with a multi-state interstate plan. What's some of the considerations of doing mass versus rate, one versus the other?
Do you want to answer that?
Sure. Chair Vega-Peterson, there's a lot of considerations. I think some of the a couple that come to mind are the perhaps, but I've heard a lot of discussion about the potential greater simplicity with the mass system that comes with issuing these allowances. The state is no longer in the business, as it would need to be under the rate system, of crediting and tracking these ERCs that would be produced from renewable energy and energy efficiency. So I think what seems to be a developing common knowledge for folks that are evaluating the Clean Power Plan is that the mass system may be simpler administratively. But I think one of the overriding concerns, if we do want to connect our plan with the region, is where these other states go. And I think there is a lot of attention right now on the mass-based systems that we're hearing from states in the West. And I think I can leave it there for right now.
Continue.
And I'll be quick. So this is just a visual of the connections that Oregon has to coal plants in both Wyoming and Utah in particular, and the challenges they have to meet the Clean Power Plan. So Oregon is not an island, and we are connected to other western states, sort of whether we like it or not. And then I think finally for me, on the PGE side, this is a small graph showing the PGE ownership of two units at the Colstrip coal facility in Montana. PGE doesn't have any retail customers outside of the state of Oregon, but you can see here that it is tied to something on the order of about a seventh of Montana's overall carbon emissions. And so in that sense, again, we're tied to other states. And so sort of reiterating the two lessons from these five slides are, one is that in terms of compliance, the state complying with the Clean Power Plan, we are in better shape than most, frankly. But that's not the entire story. The rest of the story is the impact of ratepayers, 70% of the ratepayers in the state of Oregon, and their connection to coal facilities located in other states who might have a little bit more difficult time complying with a Clean Power Plan.
I'm going to apologize to Senator Whitsitt. I think I called on the co-chair. I'm not sure. Did you get your last question answered?
Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay. More? Is there more, or is that the end?
Okay.
Next steps?
Yeah, very quickly here, just to wrap up a couple of slides. Again, my name is Colin McConaughey with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and just two slides here. One, listing some of the outreach that we have done with stakeholders over the past 5 or 6 weeks. We've met with each of these seven groups listed here individually. These have been, I think, real fruitful conversations where we have had essentially informal discussions of sharing initial reactions to the rule that EPA issued last month, to the changes that they made, and identifying some of the preferences or principles that these stakeholder groups would like the state to have as we chart a path forward in designing a state plan. It's also worth mentioning that we have met with most of these groups over the past year or more since the proposal came out in June of 2014, and we certainly plan to continue to meet with these groups going forward. Just a few next steps that we wanted to call attention to. We obviously have a lot of work ahead of us to continue evaluating this rule. EPA issued over 3,000 pages last month, and given the significant changes, it's really a new rule, and we have a lot of questions ourselves that we need to find answers to. And part of that that process will be continuing to work with stakeholders. A couple meetings we have coming up. Next week, Department of Energy is hosting a webinar with our consumer-owned utilities in Oregon that expressed interest in the Clean Power Plan to give them an overview and to determine if there's any further interest in working with the state as we develop our implementation plan. We also plan to hold a large stakeholder meeting sometime this fall to kick off more formally the state's process over the next year to get to that initial submittal date that EPA defined for us in September of next year. And it's worth noting that we also, on our to-do list, is more targeted outreach with low-income communities. EPA identifies this as a priority in their rule, and it's certainly always been a big part of the Oregon's public process. So I think on our next step on that to-do is to connect with the Oregon Environmental Justice Committee to reach out to that board. And then we also will continue to work with our counterparts in Western states so that we are mutually aware of the progress and what we're hearing from each of our stakeholder groups so that we can make some of these choices that we have ahead of us in a more informed manner. And then finally, we anticipate being in front of you folks again in the future. And then I think the next convening is in November, and we anticipate sharing a progress update at that point. And with that, I think we're done. We'll open it up to questions.
I'll add, if Senator Edwards, you can take one more presentation.
It's going to take a few more, I'm sure. Any other final questions or comments for the first panel?
One question.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. So it says work with key Western states. Have you identified which are the key Western states?
Senator Brzezinski, I think some of the most important Western states are those that Jason mentioned that we have those ties to through PG and PacifiCorps, and that would be Montana, Wyoming, Utah in particular.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And could we get a list of those toggle points that were mentioned several times during the presentation? It really helped to track this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. At what point do you think we'll know enough to be able to give the people of Oregon an idea of what they're going to have to pay more or less as a result of the rule?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, I don't have a time frame for you on that, other than that it's certainly going to be a key part of at the very least, the administrative process for DEQ, we will have to adopt a rule. We adopt this plan as part of our rulemaking process, and there's a fiscal impact assessment as part of our administrative process. But I think making the decision about the broad brushstrokes of our state plan will need to account for some financial impact. But I don't know that it at the early stages whether we'll have those rate impacts for you.
Okay, a follow up, Mr. Yes, Chair. And a far better question would be, are you going to come before us? Because you mentioned the decision. Actually, you mentioned limit our question to the decision points. Are you guys going to come back in front of us and say, okay, time for a decision? If so, when, and will we have some advance notice?
Representative Benz, mm-hmm. I don't think we know the answer to that question. What we're committing to today is to come back to the legislature frequently, including November and beyond. And I think it would be entirely appropriate for you and the other members to continue to ask that question. And I believe that there'll be a point in the time when we can answer it. I just don't know that we can tell you today, you know, when that's going to be. But we understand the constituencies and the folks that you all represent, and that question is entirely a fair one, and we'll have to be ready for it.
Thank you.
All right. So Representative Holvey, then Representative Reardon, then Senator Olson, and then we need to move on.
So do you anticipate that there will be a rate impact to ratepayers across the whole state in a proportional system, or is it going to be are the IOUs going to be impacted more than the CIUs given their generation footprint?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby. How you're going to get tired of hearing us say this. It's going to depend upon which path we take. I think it's fair to say we're still learning from each other, and so if I say the wrong thing, you'll hear it from them. If we went in a mass-based approach, because the COUs are generally not tied to fossil fuel generation in this state, it's difficult to see a lot of significant rate impact there. So in that sense, it would be more on the investor-owned utility customers. There is an argument that the Clean Power Plan might cause wholesale prices to go up somewhat. Don't ask me how much. We've heard in some of our meetings with the consumer owns about a concern that might impact them as well, to the extent that they're customers of BPA, that may not actually be a bad thing, because BPA would then be selling into a higher price market, and that would come flow back to the COU. So in a mass based, it's hard to see the 30% of customers of COU, the consumer owned utilities, experiencing much of a rate impact. But I can't say the same for the IOU customers at this point, but I don't. Obviously, I can't tell you what that might look like.
Person Reardon.
Oregon and were surveyed not too long ago and seemed to value carbon reduction. I would suggest that. And as you do your outreach and further investigations, I just wonder if it's possible to find out what they're willing to pay for that carbon reduction. So as we are designing a program, do we know? Are they willing to pay 2%, 3%? Pacific Core customers be willing to pay more than PGE customers, maybe? Or I don't know. But I think we could kind of try to identify some parameters around this decision. It might be helpful.
Senator Olson?
I guess this is a final question. When you extrapolate your two programs and work them out, will you work them out on a cost generation basis and look at them costing one to the other and then determine which one will be the cheapest for Oregonians and take it over the more expensive one?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I'm not sure which two programs are you referring to, the rate or the mass?
Yeah.
Okay. Cost will be absolutely a factor in that decision, but not the only one.
Okay.
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, I imagine that there'd be a number of criteria there. So cost would be one of them, effectiveness of the program, and so if they cost the same and you've got greater emission reductions in one, that would be something to think about. Ease of the program, Colin mentioned in answer to an earlier program that mass-based looks simpler and easier. There are going to be a number of criteria, I think, by which we would end up comparing the analysis.
All right. Thank you for the informative presentation and overview of the new Clean Power Plan rules, and we appreciate it. And this is just the beginning of the discussion with the legislature, and we'll be in touch for sure. So next up, the second panel is Climate Solutions, Kristen Sheeran, Citizens Utility Board, Bob Jenks, and the Global Warming Commission, Angus Duncan.
Come forward.
And we're going to
Okay, Chair Edwards, Peterson, and members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, and no pun intended, this afternoon I will be shorter than the people on the last panel. The next panel did talk about Oregon is well positioned to meet the state DEQ requirement for the Clean Power Plan, and that comes through a series of actions that we've done today. I want to be a little bit more specific about that. A lot of this comes out of a couple things. The PUC requires utilities to incorporate future carbon costs in utility planning. When PGE was faced with a $500 million investment in the Boardman coal-fired plant, a retrofit that would allow that plant to run until 2040, under PUC rules, they had to consider the impact of carbon regulation during that time period, and they ran a number of different carbon scenarios for that. Without planning for carbon within the utility, it's unclear to me. In fact, I think it's likely that we wouldn't have reached the decision that it was economic to shut Boardman, and Oregon's compliance costs would have been significantly greater than they are today. Again, we've been planning for a future with carbon. When you're investing in utility assets that last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you have to do that. The PUC's required people to do that, and that's part of the reason we've done decisions like Boardman that are giving us the so-called headroom. It was this legislature that passed the RPS, the 25% requirement for renewable energy by 2025. And that 25% of our energy that's coming from renewables rather than fossil generation is also making compliance easier. We have a legacy going back to when people like Angus were starting out of energy efficiency investment in this region. It predates me by a long time. If you look at from 1990...
You're saying that Angus predates you by a long time.
I'm saying energy efficiency does. It predates Angus even. But in Oregon, if you take 1990 as a baseline, our per capita, our per household energy usage, electricity has gone down by 15%. Nationally, it's gone up by 20%. That's not just different numbers. That's different directions. That 15% less energy each of our households use is several power plants that weren't built during that time period, and the emissions from those power plants are emissions that we don't have to address today. So again, it's been a lot of work by a lot of players, including the legislature, the PUC, our utilities, customers making investments that have led us to the place where we have a compliance obligation in Oregon that's not that difficult. At the same time, Oregon has a big problem with the Clean Power Plan, and I think some of Jason's talked about that, and that's the coal-by-wire, the power plants that we have in other states. And it's more in these power plants. It's Oregon ratepayers' dollars that have been invested in these power plants. Part of these power plants are dedicated to use from us. It's not just Montana, Utah, and Wyoming. There's also coal-fired power plants in Colorado, in Arizona, and Nevada that are in rate base that are dedicated to Oregon customers. And dealing with that generation, that's going to be the difficult part. That's going to be where the expense is going to come in. That's where Oregon ratepayers are going to face significant costs. A lot of those states haven't taken the same aggressive stance Oregon has on energy efficiency. They haven't given coal investments the same scrutiny as Oregon has done, but they still have compliance obligations that are going to fall on Oregon customers, Oregon ratepayers, and we're going to have to deal with that. And it's important to note that the things that I talked about in why the legislature, I give the legislature a lot of credit for passing the RPS, the cost of implementing that, the cost of building those renewables have fallen on customers. It's really customers that have bought us the headroom that exists within the state for the clean power plan. And as we go forward and try to address the issue of how do we deal with compliance and how do other states deal with compliance, keeping things affordable, keeping rates affordable for Oregon customers is to me an overriding concern. And that's why I wanted to say just my final point, and then I'm finished. And that's the DEQ, the PUC, and ODO have done a great job working together on this. They've addressed you as a group. They've addressed lots of people as a group. They've really been working together and coordinating it. And that's going to become even more important as we go forward. DEQ is the body that's going to be setting the Oregon rule. The DEQ rule is going to decide mass basis rate based. It's going to decide how we deal with emissions, extra emissions. What do we do with that headroom? Or if we're in a rate base, what do we do with the credits? And how do we do them? How are they tradable? What are the rules? And so DEQ is going to be deciding all of that. But at the same time, it's the PUC and the least cost planning by the utilities. Well, we're going to find out how this compliance obligation in other states is impacting Oregon. So it's critical that the PUC and DEQ be talking every step of the way, because the DEQ rule is going to influence how we interact with the other states, and that's going to come in through the PUC's least cost planning process to determine how the cost is for ratepayers. So if again, these agencies are doing an incredible job. I'm proud of state government the way it's working on this rule right now. But we need to hold their feet to the fire, because it's critical that these two entities really work closely together, because one's got the costs in front of it, and the other's got the rules for compliance. And those have to be lined up together. They have to be coordinated in order for us to get the best compliance plan possible and do it at the least cost. Because in the end, this is not the final shape of carbon regulation. This is the first step. This isn't going to get us to where science says we need to go. But this is the first step of carbon regulation in the country. And the better job we can do of meeting it effectively, not only in Oregon, but across the West, complying and making this rule work, but doing it at the least cost possible, the better we set the stage for the next step and the next steps that follow, and finally getting to where science says we have to get on climate. So my what I'm here to do is to urge the state government agencies of Oregon continue to work together, and let's do this and do it at the least cost for customers and make sure we comply with this rule and reduce our carbon emissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, whoever's next.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Sharon. I'm the Oregon State Director for Climate Solutions. We're a regional nonprofit organization working in Oregon and Washington to accelerate the transition to a clean energy economy and to position our region as a leader in that transition nationally and globally. I'm here today to talk about the 300-pound or 800-pound gorilla, I guess it is, in the room called climate change that hasn't come up till yet, and the intersection between Oregon's climate change goals and the Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan, make no mistake, is the single most important step that our country has taken to date to address the global challenge of climate change. Until now, existing power plants, the largest source of emissions nationwide, could release as much carbon pollution as they wanted without limit. And what's ironic is that we're talking about a country that has successfully regulated toxic pollutants. We've cleaned up our air and waterways considerably. We've removed the lead from our gasoline. We've dealt with acid rain. We've protected the ozone layer. And we've brought countless species back from the brink of extinction. But until now, until this point, we have always let emitters pollute our atmosphere at will, causing irreparable damage to our Earth's climate system with no consequences and relatively few incentives for change. Today you've heard the specifics of what the Clean Power Plan might mean for Oregon. And you've also heard that because Oregon got out early ahead on the regulatory curve, that it's now well positioned, relatively speaking, for compliance with the Clean Power Plan. And that's certainly true and something to be celebrated. And without taking away too much from the federal Clean Power Plan, I want to stress today what the Clean Power Plan and compliance doesn't do for Oregon. Compliance with the Clean Power Plan does not achieve Oregon's own legislated climate reduction goals. Compliance with the Clean Power Plan does not necessarily secure Oregon's position at the forefront of the clean energy transition nationwide. The Clean Power Plan does not protect Oregon households and businesses from the impacts of climate change already being experienced today. And it does not mean that Oregon can afford complacency, and it does not negate the need for additional state-level action. The purpose of the Clean Power Plan is to reduce emissions nationally by about a third in the power sector. But the Oregon legislature passed its own science-based greenhouse gas reduction targets for Oregon 8 years ago to arrest our emissions growth, to achieve a 10% reduction below 1990 levels by 2020, 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. And the challenge, as many of you are aware, is that we are nowhere on track for meeting our targets, and we're going to have to take additional steps to get there, that compliance with the Clean Power Plan doesn't take us. I would also like to remind us that it's been more than 8 years since Oregon has passed significant, game-changing, sort of state-level policies and programs to address emissions from our power sector. It was in 2007 when we passed our renewable portfolio standard, and of course the world has changed a lot since then. To stay at the forefront of the clean energy transition, to stay out ahead of this regulatory compliance curve that we now find ourselves benefiting from, we're going to have to push harder and faster to keep pace with other states and jurisdictions. Just to give you an example, there are now more than 29 states across the country that have renewable portfolio standards in place, some much more ambitious than Oregon's. Hawaii, for example, is moving toward 100% renewable clean energy by 2045. California, to our south, just a couple of weeks ago, increased its renewable portfolio standard to 50% by 2030. And even New York State plans to double its commitments to renewable energy to 50% over the next 15 years. Excluding biomass and hydro, there are 11 states, including Oregon, that generate more than 10% of their electricity from clean sources. Three states, though, derive more than 20% of their power from renewables. Oregon is not one of them, and surprisingly, perhaps, Iowa is in the lead with 29%. Prices for wind and solar have dropped to all-time lows and are now competitive with fossil fuel power sources in many markets. So what does all this mean in terms of the Clean Power Plan? I would wager that the Clean Power Plan largely ratifies a clean energy transition nationwide that's already well underway. Everything it involves is known, cost-effective, proven. That momentum that we've built already nationwide is what's going to allow us to reduce power sector emissions by a third nationally and save money while we're doing it. But to address the enormity of the challenge at hand, we're going to have to keep driving forward. Failure to act on climate change could be a multi-billion dollar mistake. So much of the debate over climate and energy policy, and we heard it even here today in some of the questions that were asked of the previous panel, centers on the cost of implementing new programs and regulations to address our emissions. But the often forgotten side of the coin involves the cost of inaction on climate, what we're going to pay as a result of damages resulting from a changing climate. And when you ask economists, these costs dwarf any expenses associated with transitioning to a clean energy economy under almost any and all scenarios that economists consider. Moreover, when we spend money to transition our state economy, we're making investments in infrastructure, technology, jobs. We're reducing other harmful pollutants that are often produced jointly with carbon from our tailpipes and from our power plants. When we fail to make these investments, however, we face staggering property losses from fire and sea level rise, lost agricultural outputs, impacts on our other natural resource-based industries, human health impacts, water shortages, the list goes on and on. A 2009 study from the University of Oregon showed that climate change could cost Oregon a minimum of $3.3 billion annually by the year 2020, not that far away, $5.1 billion by 2040, and $9.8 billion by 2080. More recently, the White House Council of Economic Advisors estimated damages of $150 billion per year nationwide if we fail to arrest climate change. Moreover, they warned that the cost of mitigating climate change, of dealing with the problem, increases by about 40% for every decade that we delay. Everyone in this room is well aware already that climate change is already costing us. We saw it this summer. It was sort of palpable. Everyone was talking about it, even though they might not have called it climate change. There was that sense of nervousness and unease with record-setting drought and high temperatures and, of course, the wildfires. Since June 1st, 1.5 million acres have been burned across the Northwest, Oregon and Washington, almost 600,000 acres in Oregon alone. The total firefighting cost to date exceeds $460 million in the Northwest. And that doesn't even include the cost of homes and businesses that were destroyed, disruptions to travel, and, of course, the tragic loss of life that was experienced by some of our first responders this summer. If we look at some of our other impacted sectors and industries, if we look to our coasts, a recent study by Oregon State University this year said that ocean acidification has already cost the oyster industry in the Pacific Northwest $110 million and has jeopardized about 3,000 jobs. And at the same time, this summer, we saw the largest toxic algal bloom recorded in our oceans. It shut down shellfish fisheries along the entire West Coast this summer at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars per month. And, of course, the list of climate-related impacts and how they're affecting our industries go on and on, right? I was just reading this morning about how the wine grape harvest is a month earlier than usual this year, the first time that's ever happened. What does this mean, then? The Clean Power Plan gives us an opportunity to leverage the good work, the hard work that has already been done in Oregon, and to take stock and celebrate the cumulative impact of decades of state-driven initiative, strong advocacy, and steady determination. But if we're going to bring energy solutions to scale, if we want Oregon to stay on the forefront of the clean energy transition that inevitably will happen, we're going to have to take additional state-level action. And then just briefly to wrap up, the additional state-level action that rises to the fore of importance and priority for the state that I would urge you to consider in the years and months ahead. One, we need a comprehensive program in the state of Oregon that is capable of bringing the accountability and the assurance that Oregon will meet its legislated greenhouse gas reduction targets. Secondly, we need to drive more renewable energy investment back into the state so that we can keep pace with other states and regions. So we need to revisit our commitment to our renewable portfolio standard and look to increase it. And thirdly, we need to address the fact that a third of Oregon's electric power still comes from coal-fired sources, many of which are out of state. We need to end coal by wire in Oregon and set ratepayers in Oregon free from the financial risks that we've heard about associated with coal moving forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Angus.
Thank you. Chair Vega Peterson, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I chair the state's Global Warming Commission, and I have provided you today with an extremely concise and extremely well-written summary and excerpts from the Global Warming Commission's 2015 report to the legislature, only 5 or 6 months late this year, good news, and with just enough tantalizing teasers in it that I know you'll all go to the website and download the full report and consume it with great interest. I need to be clear that I'm not representing the commission in my testimony here today, although it has taken specific positions on the draft Clean Power Plan. It has not yet had the opportunity to work through the details of the final, you know, any more than the state staff has at this point. So we're all kind of fumbling in the, if not the dark, at least the semi-gloom, to try to come up with what's the optimum path forward for the state of Oregon. But I think there are some principles that we can talk about and some guideposts, and I want to talk a little bit about those today. I'm referencing our Global Warming Commission report to remind the committee and to remind the rest of us of the close relationship between the President's greenhouse gas initiatives, most importantly, this Clean Power Plan, but also the auto fuel economy standards, and our challenge to meet the Oregon legislature's adopted greenhouse gas reduction goals. As the President said last week, the emissions reductions that he will be taking to Paris, the ones we're able to capture through presidential administrative action alone, will fall far short of what the science requires. to meet the challenges of climate science head-on will require better efforts nationally, but also better efforts by states and communities where there are different opportunities and where there are different local authorities, you know, all of which must be leveraged, many of which the federal government can't tap. We have to do those. So I want to focus my remarks on where our state's greenhouse gas reduction goals and the requirements of the Clean Power Plan can be aligned to realize the greatest emissions reductions at the least cost. This goes to Representative Reardon, your earlier comment about what our goal, what our objective ought to be in implementing the Clean Power Plan, and that I think is the objective. It's the greatest emissions reductions at the least cost. It is not minimum compliance at the least cost. That doesn't get us anywhere near our state goals. I'm going to stipulate Mr. Jegg's comments about what the state of Oregon has done so far, our commitments to energy efficiency and to renewables. I do have to admit, with sort of mix of pride and chagrin, that I can remember those early days when we proposed energy conservation be treated as a resource, and it took some time after the proposition was laid on the table before utilities and public utility commissions and others picked that up. But now, by the Northwest Power Council's planning guidelines, energy efficiency is the second largest energy resource in the Pacific Northwest. Hydro is the first. Energy efficiency is the second, eclipsing coal and gas. And that's an investment that has reaped returns for this region in the billions of dollars a year. I did a calculation once with Power Council staff, and we figured it was about a 60% average annual rate of return on investment. Pretty admirable. Somebody offers you that in penny stocks, turn and run away. But if they offer it to you in energy efficiency, you can count on it. We found the formula for ending coal combustion at Boardman in ways that advantaged Portland General, its customers, and the state as a whole. We have stayed ahead of the air quality and carbon regulatory curve by being proactive in these ways. Other states, the ones you saw on the map that Jason put up, those are the ones that are going to be coping with cost and with potential dislocations of compliance, but we will avoid those, and we'll avoid them by being ahead of that curve. We can't be smug about that. We are still, as Kristen said, short on meeting even our 2020 greenhouse gas reduction goals, let alone our 2050 goal or the Commission's newly adopted 2035 goal. We need to focus on the other states that are dealing with emissions from coal plants operated to supply Oregon loads. Now, you saw those also on Jason's map. We may not be responsible for those emissions directly under the Clean Power Plan, but we are for purposes of meeting Oregon's goals. 25% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions in our inventory every year, 25% are alone from just burning coal, mostly in plants located in other states. Those are emissions the legislature has consciously taken responsibility for in setting state goals, so we have to deal with those, not just the ones inside our borders. So we need to leverage any opportunity to reduce emissions overall, not just those emissions assigned to us by the Clean Power Plan. And if, as it at least initially appears, Oregon is effectively in Clean Power Plan compliance by 2030 already, and potentially with some headroom to spare, then the question is, how can we leverage that headroom most effectively? The first thing I think we have to remember to do is to avoid using it up at home. We have to avoid that kind of complacency. We have to meet low growth and backfield Boardman with energy efficiency and new renewables, and not with yet another gas combustion turbine. In fact, we should be growing that headroom for ourselves with our renewable and efficiency investments, not using it up with our fossil fuel investments. We can position Oregon for trading with other states by opting for a mass-based standard that positions us best to find willing partners, especially among those states with coal plants now serving Oregon loads. We can opt for a mass-based standard that includes new resources. It's one of our choices as a state Those are the gas plants that otherwise would be regulated separately for now. That would give Oregon some immediate additional headroom up front. It would also guarantee that we'll stay ahead of the inevitable future EPA requirement that will pull today's new gas plants back into the existing power plant regulatory pool and regulate them as existing plants. We can engage directly with other Western states, the ones that supply Oregon with coal by wire, to help them manage their own compliance curves in return for earlier or deeper reductions in those coal by wire power plants. That helps Oregon meet its state greenhouse gas reduction goals while helping those states cope with their clean power plant compliance deficits. And we can offer to sweeten the deal with wind-rich states like Montana and Wyoming by agreeing to take new wind generation from them in lieu of coal by wire. Use that freed up transmission east-west transmission capacity by putting wind energy on it. That eases job dislocation in those states while diversifying the wind regimes from which we can serve Oregon loads. That adds to system stability. There will be parties arguing for simply handing our headroom over to utilities with out-of-state power plants to buy rate relief from compliance costs, or arguments to monetize Oregon allowances for sale into a national allowance market, the kind of markets that are expected to emerge. And there may be reasonable rationales for doing some of this, but we have to remember when we do it, it simply enables more coal to be burned and more greenhouse gas emissions to be released. So there's a clear trade-off between rate relief for us and more emissions from those other states. All options need to be tested against that first principle: optimum emissions reductions at the least cost, not minimum compliance. Any letting go of Oregon allowances that Oregonians worked hard to create should not be frustrating that accomplishment and all that hard work by Oregonians to simply enable more coal to be burned elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right.
Yes.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. At the same time that the residential use of electricity went down about 15%, the price of natural gas went down by 75%. The U.S. reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States are near 1990 levels and falling like a stone, almost entirely due to the free market-driven use of natural gas. So an example here in Oregon is the Bend Lapine School District changed over 60% of their bus fleet, school bus fleet, from diesel to propane. The cost went from $3.11 a gallon for diesel at the time to $1.30 a gallon for propane. They got better mileage, they got less wear and tear on the engine, and they reduced their emissions by about 80%. So why are we not advocating for a free market-driven expansion of the use of natural gas? I didn't hear anything about that today. That is what has been driving down, the primary thing that's been driving down our emissions in the United States, and yet you're not advocating for that free market-driven enterprise. Why?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think the switch from natural gas, that's part of what's happened with energy efficiency. Part of that 15% reduction since 1990 in energy use is a changeover, energy efficiency changeover from inefficient electric baseboard heating to natural gas furnaces that are much more efficient and save customers money. Energy efficiency saves people money. Inefficient uses of electricity versus efficient uses of gas do that. I've installed a 96% efficient natural gas furnace in my house, and I'm quite happy with it. And it saves me money, and it gives me comfort and all of that. So I think that is part of the energy efficiency story. I think some of that rollover within residential houses gets lost in those energy efficiency numbers, not called out as fuel switching for various appliances, but it's an element of it. And I think you're right. It has led to lower costs and reduced emissions for customers of Oregon. So
And if I can go on, Senator Whitsitt, so actually the way EPA is structuring the Clean Power Plan, it is one kind of thin step away from a national market in opportunities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the most efficient way possible. That may certainly, almost certainly, early on will be displacing coal generation with gas generation. But ultimately, this is not just a question, as I said, of minimum compliance at least cost. It's a question of hitting greenhouse gas targets at least cost. And we can do that with a combination of gas and renewables and efficiency displacing coal. And that's fairly clearly where we're headed. Even EPA has been very clear that by 2030, they still expect a significant contribution to national energy markets from coal. They expect a much larger one from gas. They expect a much larger one from renewables. And the other thing that we are seeing is significant drops in the cost of both wind and solar. And we're seeing those technologies competing head up with gas and coal for new RFPs, particularly, you know, for wind in the windy states like Wyoming and Montana, for solar in the sunny states like Arizona and Utah. So the market is clearly the single most important element in driving the shift within electricity markets from coal to other resources, and that's going to continue. That is not to say, though, that that state and federal policies will not have an impact. And it is interesting to note, I think, that when ACEEE, which is a national energy efficiency analysis group, does its annual rating of states that have the best capture of energy efficiency, it's always Oregon, Washington, and eight states that have power costs 2 to 3 times what ours are, which is not to say that those costs are not significant, but it is to say that you can significantly leverage up on the curve with the right kind of targeted energy efficiency programs of the sort, the Energy Trust, for example, that Oregon enjoys.
I would just point out that I believe the 2 cent per kilowatt hour wind energy tax credit is still in place, is it not?
It is, as are any number of subsidies that accrue to fossil fuels.
I know of no subsidy that is a 25% one, but we talk about that offline.
Okay. Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Angus, thank you for your years of working on this. One of the things that seems to slip into the background and the remarks about our challenges in the forest this year and temperature, these are remarks about today, and yet the activities, the CO2 reductions talked about today will not have an impact for many years into the future. And that there's always seems to be this assumption that if we do this today, we won't have forest fires next year. That's not the case, is it?
Absolutely not the case.
And so the numbers that I've heard in discussions last week and over the last couple of years is that the best we could hope for, given China and all of that and others, is that a stabilization of the current CO2 situation sometime in 25 to 30 years from now, which means that the activities we engage in today and that we pay for today will not have an impact on Oregon and its climate for many, many decades to come. So last week there was a discussion over at Salishan about rising sea levels, about forest fires, about all the consequences of a warmer, hotter, drier. And yet when I brought up the word adapt, it was as though I'd uttered some sort of a unfortunate phrase that no one wanted to think about. Yet there's this big, huge space where I think we're going to have to. So my question to you is, how do we measure, on the one hand, the CO2 reduction and the cost that goes with it against spending the same dollars on trying to get ready for what bad things are going to happen if indeed the link is there that 62% of Oregonians polls show believe between CO2 and
and these fires. What? Why is it that we're spending it on reduction? And I think the answer over there in Salishan was because we need to set an example. That was the best answer that was given. And we can talk about the minute amount. I don't really want to do that. I really want to know how we make a choice between the two alternatives, adapt versus CO2 reduction. Now, you think about this all the time, so what's your thinking?
Representative Benz, thank you. It's just the sort of naughty question I would expect from you. and it's going to take till at least 5 o'clock to answer it.
No, it's not.
All right. We'll try to be a little more concise. So let me give you two answers. You know, one is simply a procedural answer, which is that, you know, I absolutely agree that you can't spend all of your time on reduction and none of it on adaptation and preparation. And in fact, the commission has committed over the next to sending you another report next year, which will be focused entirely on adaptation and preparation, you know, to update, you know, what was a good but very limited effort that the state agencies made back in 2010. But clearly things have progressed significantly since then, and we have to revisit, you know, what our level of commitments are and what the level of threat is to the state of Oregon. The second part of the answer is going to have to be a little more metaphorical in order to beat the 5 o'clock deadline. And that goes, I think, to a subject that is probably near to your heart and to that of a number of other folks in the committee, and that is forest health and forest fires. And it is instructive to look at the evolution of the Forest Service budget over the last 10 to 15 years, and you probably are as familiar with this as I am, but it has gone from 15 or 20 years ago actually being where forest firefighting consumed about 10% of the Forest Service budget to today when it consumes in excess of 50% of the Forest Service's budget. Now, that argues for a couple of things. One is for bumping up the Forest Service budget and making it a lot more flexible. But the other thing it argues is that we can't choose between these two. We will be obliged to deal with the effects of climate change because they are thrust upon us in the forests, you know, on the coastline, in the snowpack, and we have to figure out how to cope with those. The risk is we'll shift all of our resources to coping with the effects and not spending the money on the investments to reverse this, at least for our children or our grandchildren. And we have to do that because it doesn't get easier or cheaper if we continue to defer the emissions reduction efforts. If we had started working on both of these 20 years ago, the cost of dealing with both of them would be far lower than they are today. If we defer working on both of these for another 5 or 10 years, the costs simply go up.
And some of us also believe that it argues that we should engage in more active management on our federal forests as well. That's also a piece of it.
And actually, putting my Bonneville environmental hat on, we are talking with PGE and with some of the folks in the forests about whether there is a way to thread that needle between protecting forest ecosystem health on the one hand and reducing fuel loading, especially in east side forests, on the other, and doing it in a way that allows us to roll some of that forest residue over into energy production. So
we've got one more panel to go, and you caught us up a little bit. I appreciate that. I'm going to let you guys go. I'm going to call the next panel up, and if they can catch us up by 5 minutes, then we'll end at 5 o'clock. So Portland General Electric, Pacific Corp, Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, and EWEB. I'll let you guys work out who's going first, second, third, and fourth.
All right. Mr. Chair, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Just to introduce you a little bit to the company, I know that we've covered a lot of ground, but Pacific Corp is headquartered in Portland. We serve 6 states, about 1.8 million customers across the states. We service 2 retail business units. So in
Scott,
Oregon.
Did you say your name?
Yes.
Okay.
Scott Bolton.
Thank you.
We serve Oregon, Washington, California as Pacific Power, about 550,000 customers here in Oregon, and then Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho as Rocky Mountain Power. We're a vertically integrated utility, and essentially what that means is we produce, transmit, and sell at retail electricity, so kind of the cradle-to-grave production delivery of electricity. We do this across the West's largest privately owned transmission network, and the generation portfolio is about 11,500 megawatts, or about half of the Bonneville system. So it's a pretty large generation supply, and it's frankly reflective of the geographical diversity of the service territory footprint. So for instance, in Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho, we in the Rocky Mountain interior west states, we have coal plants, we have gas plants, lots of wind. Frankly, most of our wind development over the last few years has been in eastern Wyoming. And in the west, we have a number of hydropower plants, a little bit of gas, and some biomass as well. So really, the energy resources are from where they live, and we share those among those six states on a cost allocation basis based on their load. So for instance, for our purposes, Oregon is about 28% of the cost of our system. So that hydropower plant in Oregon, 28% of which it serves, is paid for and serves customers in Oregon, the 72% of that plant would be purchased and carried by customers in five other states, same as coal plants in Wyoming. So it's an integrated system, and as I think is eloquently pointed out by both Bob Jenks and Jason Eisdorfer, the way we look at addressing a clean power plan, we're all in it together. It isn't just a one state for themselves approach would be the best way to go. So federal carbon regulation has been something we've anticipated for a long time, and we've been planning our system for future carbon regulation. As Mr. James pointed out, this is something that's been in it, that's been baked into our integrated resource plan for quite some time. This is good because it's allowed us to start forecasting what future costs would look like and anticipate that and plan accordingly. We've known that federal carbon regulation was inevitable, and we've been planning to transition to a lower emitting suite of resources as we go forward. I had a PowerPoint presentation, but in the interest of time, I'll just blow through this. Our latest integrated resource plan, which is the 2015 IRP, is the first one that captures the clean power plan, at least in its draft rule inception. And so for that IRP, we anticipated if this rule were the law of the land, how would our resource mix need to look in order to comply? We've put that out there, and folks can go on our website, and I'd be happy to provide it to the committee, what the 2015 IRP shows. And what it shows is a couple of very interesting things. One is that our transition to coal from coal to cleaner resources accelerates between now and 2034. We go from about 60%, 61% of our energy mix being met with coal today to below 31, 32% by 2034. It's a pretty big reduction over a relatively short period of time from a utility planning perspective. This doesn't anticipate or doesn't reflect the final power plan. And as the first panel highlighted, there were quite a few differences between the final rule and the draft rule, and we're still looking through the rule to see how that works. But in our 2015 IRP update, which we'll produce next year, it will reflect what the final plan looks like. The other thing that our IRP and our resource planning is producing is a much heavier reliance on energy efficiency. We believe that we can meet 85% of our load growth with just energy efficiency. We do believe that we're going to meet the targets on a state-by-state basis of the Clean Power Plan, and we'll do it with the existing resources that we have. We don't have to build a lot of new power plants to meet the new standards, but we do have to use those power plants much differently. We'll have to use coal a lot less. We'll have to use gas more. And again, that's with current resources, not with new additions. In fact, the current IRP doesn't anticipate a new gas plant until 2028 at the earliest. And a lot can happen between now and then. So, excuse me. So, we strongly believe that the 111D rule of the Clean Power Plan can be met cost effectively, but a lot of that has to do with designs and what the states do. And as you've heard today, how Oregon approaches this, whether Oregon goes it alone or works with other states, is yet to be determined. For Oregon, our carbon footprint and that which is within the state's jurisdiction is actually quite small. We have a single power plant, the Hermiston gas plant, that is our only fossil fuel plant in the state. But clearly, decisions made by regulators in states like Utah, Wyoming, Montana, have some bearing on what Oregon's ultimate cost would be for our customers, for consumers across the state. And so we've strongly encouraged from the very beginning of the creation of the Clean Power Plan for states to try to work together, that we do believe that multi-state approaches and being able to leverage attributes of those states amongst themselves is really the lowest cost, easiest path to compliance. We believe we can get there whether Oregon participates in a multi-state approach or not. Again, Oregon's a piece of the puzzle and not the biggest piece of the puzzle, but we do think very strongly that's in Oregon's interest to work with those other states and to find ways to collaborate and use the headroom or the capabilities of Oregon being ahead of the curve to benefit, frankly, Oregon customers by helping the whole region solve its greenhouse gas emissions reduction obligation. So I think I'll just kind of wrap up there and hand it off to Varner, because I'm sure folks will have a lot of questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, Chair Vega-Peterson, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. For the last year, PGE has been working pretty closely with the state agencies and with the United States Environmental Protection Agency on the design of the Clean Power Plan and the rules that you have in front of you. First, I want to say that it's been very positive working with the state agencies between Department of Energy, DEQ, and the PUC, and we want to recognize the work that staff have done. They've been pretty collaborative in that approach, and we recognize that hard work on their part. There's a lot more work to do. They've been a pretty good partner in this so far, and we thank them for that. We're committed to fully engaging as we go forward in the development of this state implementation plan. We intend to comply with the state implementation plan. We think that the Clean Power Plan is going to be the rule of the land, and we intend to comply with it. There are three points I want to make today. The first is that as we look at the Clean Power Plan, we think de facto it creates a price on carbon and a market approach for dealing with carbon emissions regionally and potentially nationally. The second is we want to distinguish the early action we've taken. We're not sure that it actually creates headroom in the way that people have talked a little bit here, and I want to clarify that point briefly. And then third, we want to talk a little bit about some design issues. So first off, the Clean Power Plan does put limits on emissions. I think what the folks were talking about from the state earlier in terms of putting the numbers up there, it puts limits in terms of the emissions that we can have as the state. For PGE, where we're looking at either allowances or credits, depending on what the state plan is, that we would need to use to comply with our generation that occurs in other states, that necessitates some trading back and forth and some transfer of those credits. When you start to look at the elements of putting a upper limit and then having trading, those are the elements of a cap and trade system. So for folks who are having conversations about wanting to go to a cap and trade system in the state of Oregon, we would assert that for the purposes of looking at regulation of carbon emissions in the electrical sector, what you've heard described here today very much goes in the direction of having a price and a market for carbon emissions. As folks have noted, we've done a lot of early work in the state of Oregon, and in the Oregon Global Warming Commission report to the legislature some months late, as noted by Angus, that you've got on your in front of you right now. One of the things we've seen is statewide, from 1990 to 2012, per capita emissions have decreased about 22%. That's in the report. For the Portland metro area, which is the core of our service territory, the emissions on a per capita basis are down 34%. So down by about a third in the last 22 years on a per capita basis. Now, that's offset somewhat in terms of total emissions because as folks who drive in the Portland metro area are fully aware, the population's been growing. So we have some increase in terms of overall population, but per capita the emissions are down. Talk about the headroom issue for a second point. One of the things that when we looked at the calculation of the rate and or the mass-based level for Oregon, it did not include in the calculation, according to EPA, it did not include the Carty Generating Plant, which is a new natural gas-fired plant that we have under construction right now in Morrow County. We sent a letter to EPA to clarify whether that would be treated as a new resource or as an existing resource. They didn't give us complete guidance, but they suggested our ruling that it, or our reading of the law, that it could be treated as a new resource was inaccurate. So that leads us to believe that it will be a plant covered under this rule. And we think that as we look at it with the existing calculations, we're not in an area where we have surplus or we do have headroom. That's different from saying that we've taken early action and that's put us in a positive state position relative to compliance. We do think that the early work and the decades of investment that Oregonians have made puts us in an advantageous position. We're not sure that there's necessarily headroom. And when we look at the relationship with the Intermountain states and that essentially our customers are going to need to pay for some of the emissions reductions that occur in Montana, Utah, Wyoming, or for our customers, just Montana, and that those folks have some challenge there, we think that also kind of counts against the notion that there is headroom. And then finally, the final point that I would make is that when we look at, and I think some folks have asked the question about what's the cost of this going to be, and I think that to be fair, as folks are trying to understand a 1,600-page rule with a couple hundred pages or several hundred pages more of tables, it's hard right now to know what the cost is going to be. With that said, the state has choices to make in terms of the design of the rule, between rate-based, between mass-based, and our preference would be that as the state is looking at reducing carbon emissions, that the goal should be reducing carbon emissions and doing so at the lowest possible cost to consumers here in the state of Oregon, both residential and businesses. That the point of this should be reducing carbon emissions, complying with the plan. It shouldn't be on trying to inflict sort of the maximum pain on folks who are paying those bills. So as we get into the design of the implementation plan, which we're looking forward to engaging in, we think that doing it at the lowest possible cost should be a priority for the state. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and Chair Vega-Peterson. My name is Carl Fink, and I'm here on behalf of the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, or NPSI, and we represent the independent generators within the state, as well as the energy suppliers who operate in Oregon. And it might surprise folks in the room to know that we actually operate more generation in the state of Oregon than the other two utilities combined. That's true on both a thermal basis for those plants that are going to be subject to this rule, as well as overall. As independent power producers, though, we do not have ratepayers, and we are not guaranteed an opportunity to earn a return on our investment. So when we look at this rule, we think it's very important to keep in mind that the design has to be something that works for everybody and cannot just be designed based on ratepayers. As independent power producers, though, we risk our own money, and it causes us to be very technologically savvy and careful. We were the first producers of wind generation in the state, and we produced most of the wind generation in the state. We were the first developers of solar generation in the state, utility scale, and have produced most of the utility scale solar generation. And that's true throughout the world. We believe that a mass-based regional trading program is in the best interest of Oregon, and we think that we can get comfortable with many kinds of trading programs, but we want to see four concepts included as we develop these plans. First, as I said, we will be complying with the rule, but we do not have ratepayers, so the way that the plan is designed, whether it's allowances that are held by the state or given to various people, it just has to have parity. It's not something that can be just done with the utilities because they are not the bulk generators within the state. Second, I think it's very important that we all recognize the very important work that the Energy Facility Siting Council has done, particularly with Chapter 469, Section 503, which requires any generation to get sited in the state has to meet some very stringent carbon requirements. We've all done that for our plants, and those rules that we must meet are significantly more stringent than the Clean Power Plan currently requires. So to get sited, we either have to meet these very stringent rules or we have to pay for carbon reduction. So we, and here I mean not just the independents but the utilities as well within the state, have already mitigated our carbon footprint for all generation that we have. We talked a little bit about the leakage problem for the new plants and old plants, and I think that the same process will work for that because we can, in siting new plants, impose upon the new plants the same costs as are otherwise going to be required under the CPP. And briefly, another point that I think is important is, as we've talked about, Oregon is not an island. We import quite a bit of our power. We also export quite a bit of our power. And it's important in any plan to harmonize the rules amongst the various states so that we don't require generators to pay three and four times for one ton of carbon. So, for example, right now, if we export power into California, California imposes a fairly high fee for the price of that carbon as part of their cap and trade program. So, as an independent generator that exports power, we've paid for that carbon reduction first under the FSEC process. Second, we expect we will pay for it under the CPP process. And third, we currently would be paying for it. And remember, this is the same ton of carbon, the same emission, three different times. So in designing the rule, we think it's very important to have a regional approach that harmonizes these costs and recognizes if someone is paying these costs and reducing their carbon, whether it's in Montana or in Oregon or in California, that you are not required to pay a third time for that same emission. And the last point I'll make is we should not lose sight of the potential value to Oregon of a market-based trading system. How much headroom we have is not necessarily clear, but we are certainly in a better position than many of the other states. What Oregon would choose to do with any revenue that may become available, whether that is for environmental justice programs, whether that is to incent further industrial efficiency, whether that is to incent further renewable development, there is a great deal of opportunity for the state. And if we work on a mass-based regional program, I think the state would find a great building block for economic development. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Jason. Chair Edwards and Chair Vega Peterson. For the record, I'm Jason Huser, Government Affairs Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I have an eye on the clock, and I'm going to try to shorten my testimony. I hope it won't be choppy. It's a short message, but best delivered in person, so thank you for the opportunity to be here. EWEB is a municipal utility serving 90,000 customers in Eugene and the McKenzie River Valley. We purchase about half our power from the Bonneville Power Administration. We self-supply the other 50% from a mix of three dams, wind farms, a biomass plant, as well as cogeneration at two local paper mills. There's 36 other consumer-owned utilities in Oregon. They buy almost all of their power from Bonneville. At the end of the day, all 37 consumer-owned utilities have almost the same fuel mix. It's 95% emission-free power. That's predominantly hydropower, followed by energy efficiency. I know for EWEB, 12% of our power portfolio is comprised of energy efficiency, 70 average megawatts. It's a nice little virtual power plant. So at the end of the day, that 5%, that actually comes from market purchases.
the fossil fuel mix in our portfolio. There's not a whole lot that any of the consumer-owned utilities can really do about that. Market purchases are a part of life. There is no electric generating unit that uses fossil fuels that's owned or operated by EWEB, any of the Oregon consumer-owned utilities, or in the federal Columbia River Power System marketed by BPA. So for EWEB and Oregon's other COUs, our primary role with regard to greenhouse gas emissions reductions seems to fall outside of the EPA's clean power rule. The EPA role looks to be focused on fossil-fired electric generating units and not necessarily load-serving entities like utilities, unless they are the operators of fossil units. And also, the rule is focused on reducing carbon from existing electric generating units. So Oregon consumer-owned utilities, we can't reduce what we don't have. I think really our contribution to Oregon's energy future, again, falls outside of the rule in that we're going to continue doing what we've been doing, and that's really carbon avoidance rather than carbon reduction. There's a massive investment made by consumer-owned utilities to acquire energy efficiency. Consumer-owned utilities in the Pacific Northwest have acquired 560 megawatts of energy efficiency just since 2010. The other thing is, I know for some utilities, they're also looking at peak demand needs. They may have all the energy they need on an annual basis, but in EWEB's case, we're actually surplus. We've got more power than we need, but there are times of the year when we're having trouble meeting peak demand during a cold snap. We want to avoid using a natural gas turbine to meet peak demand, so we're going to be investing in demand response. It's kind of like energy efficiency 2.0, so to speak. So I guess in closing, I would just say, I think it's no secret that it's advantageous to be a hydro-based utility when entering a carbon-constrained world, but I do want folks to know hydropower is not without its own challenges right now, too. Many components of the federal hydro system are long overdue for maintenance, modernization, and new environmental costs. The same is true for EWEB's largest dam on the McKinsey River, which is going through relicensing right now, and these investments are not going to be cheap. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
All right. Questions?
Thank you, Scott.
Comments?
Real short.
No, you guys did great. I thought we'd have some more questions. I know Representative Reardon wants to ask a question.
It's more of a comment.
Or make a comment. Yeah. Go ahead.
I am really concerned about snowpack, so I think we need to think about all of this and how we play together.
Yeah, Representative Hill.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question for Mr. Fink, and I'm sorry if I missed this. I think you're all moving fast with your testimony. What percentage of the independent power producers' total portfolio would renewables account for?
Thank you, Representative Helm. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can provide it to you.
A ballpark would be fine for today.
I believe it is substantially more than half. Independent power producers have three large gas plants operating in the state, one in Klamath Falls and two in the northeastern part of the state. A substantial portion of the independent power is wind.
Thank you.
Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Chair Edwards. I hesitate to broach the subject of the question, but this particular E&E legal report is a compilation of a string of emails from FOIA requests from all 50 states, and it's at least interesting. But the report delineates how much of the concept of the EPA Clean Energy Plan rule originated with former Governor Kitzhaber, Sylvia Hayes, Dan Carroll, Murky Hoffman, and others in his staff, Curtis Robinhole. The Under the Radar project he created employs several privately funded NGOs to organize and build support, and the scheme was actually repeatedly referred to as Dan's plan throughout this email deal. Part of Dan Carroll's plan was to use the investor-owned utilities to leverage acceptance of the clean energy plan in the red or flyover states. you go to page 21 of the report, one illustrative scenario is the leveraging of political influence on certain vulnerable players in the electric utilities industry. The object is to cause the utilities to lobby vulnerable Republican governors to champion their cause. And so the question for you gentlemen is, to your knowledge, have any of your companies been approached to enlist the company's aid in influencing red state political support for Obama's EPA clean energy plan?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, no. Senator Whitfitt, I'm not aware of our company being approached in this way.
Chair Edwards, Chair Vega Peterson, no, we don't. As a matter of practice, PGE doesn't do any lobbying outside the state of Oregon. No, we haven't. We don't actually. We do some monitoring of legislation in Washington, won't lobby in Washington.
Thank you for those answers. Appreciate it.
Any questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I actually am pretty enthused by all what I'm hearing. It sounds like Oregon is in good shape. And a couple of things, if we are going to continue on our, and I think a lot of these utilities have been working on these things for, if you've been following this for quite some time now. And some of the things that weren't talked about today that are in the renewables realm are big solar, like in Bence's neck of the woods, so to speak. And I think we should really concentrate on a lot of that. That's what they've got over there. That's what they could do. Ocean energy, offshore wind, things like that in the coastal areas. And because we're always worried about what happens when the big one hits us, that we will be cut off from the transmission from you guys, which is a bummer. But if we have our own thing over there, we'll be able to take care of ourselves and maybe export some of it back to you. So I'm enthused.
I'm chuckling at your characterization of it as being a bummer.
A bummer.
That would be a bummer.
It is a bummer.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
In your work and discussions on preparing for this changeover, have you done any work on rates and how it's going to impact your clients?
Yeah. Chair Edwards, Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson. We're beginning to do some modeling in terms of what the rate impact would be and to come up with some preferences in terms of what we think would be the lowest cost option for implementation of the plan. I think right now, if we make some decisions and some decisions in terms of how the allowances are allocated or credits are allocated, depending on what type of approach we take, we think this could be fairly low cost. If we get into other parties who aren't obligated entities or aren't regulated under the plan, getting allowances and we have to buy them back from them or we have to auction them off or buy them in an auction, or if they're seen as a revenue-raising measure, we think that raises the cost pretty significantly. And just one note, I actually had an error in answering Senator Whitsitt's question a second ago. We do have a lobbyist in Montana where we're part of an owner in the Colstrip plan, so just to correct that. But to the fundamental question, we haven't been lobbying the governor's office around the Clean Power Plan or asking for them to support it. Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Olson, I agree with Barner's assessment. It really is premature to be able to extrapolate these costs into actual rate impacts at this point. And there's so many moving pieces. You know, it's those toggle switches as far as decisions that states make. And then what, for us, especially as a regional utility, what is the combined impact of how the states work together, don't work together, or the choices that they make along the way? What I would say is that we do feel pretty confident that we're going to be able to meet the state-by-state reductions and do so on a pretty affordable or reasonable basis because we have a lot of flexibility in our system. We do have a lot of power plants. We have a lot of different technologies. We have the ability to increase, as I said, even beyond where we are today, where I think we have a pretty robust energy efficiency program throughout the company, even in you know, in Oregon we use the energy trust model, but in all of our other states we deliver our energy efficiency programs directly to our customers. We see a lot of opportunity for ramping those programs up as well. So energy efficiency really will become the first and future resource for us going forward. And then it really is about changing business practices from just dispatching power on a purely economical basis. So when power plants operate, how often they operate, and in what order has always traditionally been determined by least cost. What's the cheapest electron I can get out into consumers' hands? Now it really has an overlay of we've got to do this in a way that's going to meet environmental targets. And so that change from economic dispatch to an environmental and economic dispatch model is basically, it's that carbon price, it's that change in business practice. And those costs and the factors that we'll be seeing going forward as we move transition into more of that model really will be issues around what's the forward price of natural gas. So as we use more gas, will gas be relatively cheap? Will it be more expensive? We will have more exposure there, so that will be an issue that we'll have to address and mitigate. The other will be what's the availability of other systems resources? And trust me, this is like a whole nother 3-hour panel, but one of the areas that we've been making a lot of investment of time and resource has been in opening up Western regional markets. We've opened up what's called an energy imbalance market. Other utilities have been joining. That's been a partnership with the transmission operator of the state of California. And that has compelled us to explore further integrating regional markets, transmission markets across the West, even beyond just system balancing needs. This could give us the opportunity to draw on other regions, other utilities resources, and be able to buy supplies in ways that we can't today. And can do so based on what the energy mixes are. So if you look at California, for instance, California overgenerates solar certain hours of the day, meaning they produce more solar power than they're able to absorb. And so they either have to curtail those plants or find some other way to basically dump power. It's a problem, and it's a problem that we can solve if we're able to participate in a day-ahead market with California where we know that power will be there. We can purchase that power, we can do so at a competitive price, and be able to back down fossil fuel resources because we know we can get a clean electron somewhere else. Those types of market dynamics, those changes are coming within the timeline of the Clean Power Plan coming online. And so we are fairly confident that we think we can meet these targets, we can make these goals, and do so with an expanding toolbox.
Yeah, Representative Vance.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if your future needs in Oregon come from conservation, do I have to fold up my plans for my 10,000-acre solar farm? And in all seriousness, is there any chance that Oregon would be a source of that type of green energy as you wind down or whatever you're going to do with your so-called coal by wire?
Representative Vance, I think there's a couple different ways to answer that. I mean, first, we will continue to be opportunistic for resources that are low cost and are a good addition to the mix to serve customers. So where we find competitively priced resources and where that resource is going to be cheaper than either something we have today or something that we otherwise would get tomorrow, that's something we're always going to be open and in the market for. So, these things aren't static. I do think, the ability to trade up and improve the portfolio along the way is something that we will always consider. But energy efficiency will always be the lowest cost resource. It's the energy you don't need. And where we can maximize investments in energy efficiency and, we want people to use electricity, just don't use more than you need. And making sure that we're using the asset base that we have as wisely and efficiently as possible will always be the first choice and, frankly, the easiest path towards meeting our environmental goals as well.
Yeah. Since nobody seems to be able to put their thumb on a price or rate relations, what will happen if suddenly our consumers determine that we're in sticker shock because the rates are going to go up 25, 30, or 40%. What do we do then?
Well, Chair Edwards, Chair Peterson, Senator Olson, I think that one of the things we're going to be working on with the agency is try to avoid that. And I think that getting into a situation of sticker shock or having high compliance costs, I don't think would be in the public interest. And I don't think it's in the interest of our customers. And so I think we're going to try to work, and we're going to be advocating to keep the design choices as low cost as possible. And I think one of the things that we don't want to see happen is where investor-owned utilities have a much higher rate structure than some of the public power entities that get their power from the federal government. So I think that I think that we're going to be working pretty hard to avoid getting into a sticker shock situation. I think it's hard to say that there aren't going to be some costs associated with this plan and, you know, with the retirement of Boardman and some of the other things going on. We've got some additional RPS procurement that's going to take place. To date, those have been fairly low cost drivers. I think there are some ways to manage those costs and keep them relatively low, but, you know, none of this can be done for free. And so I think that we're very serious in talking about what are those design elements that we put together to try to keep the cost as low as possible. And I think that it's going to be important for the agencies as we work forward to keep that first and foremost in their minds of what is this cost and how do we pay for it. I mean, I know it's not satisfying to answer that question because we're not saying it's going to cost this or that, but it is, I think, a pretty relevant issue that we have to look at going forward.
So what's it?
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Mr. Bolton, from your perspective, does your company need a cap-and-trade system or an energy rate credit system in place to meet your goals? To meet the goals, or could you reach those goals by the type of trades that you were just speaking about, buying and selling on the open market?
Could you clarify, Senator, do you mean the Clean Power Plan goals or the state emission reduction goals? Because they're different.
I'm sorry.
Are you talking about the Clean Power Plan goals or targets, or are you talking about the state's legislatively adopted goals for
either way? Do you need an overriding cap and trade or energy credit system, or can you do it on the open market? Just tell us what we need to do and we'll go do it.
Right. Senator, it's actually a great question. I think for our planning purposes, we look at, absent all other policy mechanism, what would it take for my company to be able to meet the Clean Power Plan requirements on each jurisdictional basis. And so the types of tools I just described, such as opening up more variety of resources and connectivity within Western markets, to be able to switch fuels between burning less coal and having more gas capability, increasing energy efficiency programs, those are things that we can and will do to meet it. Cap and trade programs or, you know, renewable attribute credit trading, those are policy mechanisms that can lower the costs beyond where we think we're going to be. So certainly if we had a robust trading market or if there were other, what I would describe as policy supports that were focused on helping the consumer or helping Oregon's economic competitiveness, those are things that would improve that picture even more than where we think we would probably be. But as a standalone company looking at the federal regulation and looking at just within our own fence line of our own system and our own customer base, we don't plan for or lean on those policy mechanisms as what gets us across the finish line. They can help a lot. And you know, conversely, states can make decisions that could hurt a lot too along the way. But as Varner said, and I think, you know, our consumer advocates have also echoed, hopefully the goal of this body and state policymakers is to try to get there with as little pain and with as much cost effectiveness in mind as possible. That's definitely a core principle of ours.
Maybe we take that as a no.
No, we don't need it, but we could use it. We're willing to wait and see what emerges.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you. And I don't know if this panel can answer this question, but maybe, or maybe it's a question for the agencies. I mean, because Varner sort of referred to this similar to a cap and trade system, and it does have those similar attributes. So I'm wondering, California has a cap and trade system. So, and I noticed on their graphs that they're in that bar graph. I would have expected that they were going to have big problems, but they were actually on the downside of that. So I guess my question is that California cap-and-trade system substantially helping them meet already or come close to meeting those goals of the CPP? And how, I mean, and it would be impacting those utilities already.
Yeah, Representative Holvey, I think that question is not answered yet. That California's cap and trade system, as currently designed, does have some conflicts with the requirements of the Clean Power Plan. And there probably will have to be some considerable work to align those programs or figure out what to do with the electricity sector in particular, which falls under the Clean Power Plan. We do business, we're a retail utility in Northern California. We are subject to California's cap and trade program. We have no fossil fuel generation in the state of California. We already have one irregularity right there. And certainly California's cap and trade program envisions a much broader participation than certainly just electric utilities. So whether those, whether there's a good alignment there or whether you can just cut and paste California's program and have that be compliant with what the EPA is looking for in this rule, I think is a question that hasn't been answered yet.
Matthew. Oh, go ahead. Brief.
Thank you.
Briefly. Yesterday, last night, I was reading a white paper that the California Air Resources Board put out on their cap and trade system and interaction with 111D. There's a basic challenge where if we were to do trading with Montana, and Montana didn't have a full cap and trade system in place, and we had things like California where you can get allowances and credits from manufacturing or forestry or other things, those wouldn't count over there towards their electrical reductions. And so you get some challenges with if we were to go a California type route, that would potentially limit the ability to do trading under the Clean Power Plan with some of the Intermountain states. Notably, California has in the California Resources Board paper, they're recommending a go-it-alone route for California, not trading with other states, in part because of some of the challenge of interoperability. I think our position is that there's significant complexity with the Clean Power Plan. To have an additional state cap-and-trade system on top of that, we think would get pretty hard to figure out how that would work and what the mechanics of it would be, given that in a cap and trade like California, there are allowances for non-electrical sector type emissions.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, any final thoughts before we...
Well, I have another question. That raised another question, but we'll talk about it offline.
Okay.
But no, I think we're good. Five minutes over, not bad. So,
thank you, everybody, who has participated in the panel today. Thank you, legislators, for staying engaged the whole hearing. I think there were some good questions, some good illuminations as the state struggles not only what to do administratively and legislatively with implementation of the Clean Power Plan, but how we move forward toward meeting our goals, our greenhouse gas reduction goals as a state, which certainly is a goal of mine. So with that, we're adjourned.
Yeah, we're adjourned. All right. Yeah, we're adjourned. All right.